Good afternoon. Welcome to all of you. We are hopefully trying to start on time, and we are starting as a subcommittee of the committee. Subcommittee of one, we're allowed to do that under the rules. So welcome to the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources for April 3rd, 2003. We have four bills on the docket today. We intend to hear all four of them. And, of course, before we get started, we, as I always do, want to make you aware of if you are a government official or a paid lobbyist, or registered lobbyist, rather, by signing the witness registration sheet, you are acknowledging that you are bound by and recognize that you are under two ORSs to give truthful and accurate testimony. If you are from the general public, this does not apply to you. However, we still want you to give us truthful and accurate testimony. So, having said that, we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2957. Ray, if you want to tell us what this bill does, we'll get started.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2957 imposes restrictions on the ability of state and local government units to impose food labeling requirements. Mr. Chair, we have before us a Dash 1 amendment which replaces the original measure, and the Dash 1 amendment bars local governments from imposing disclosure or display requirements for food label, bars state government from imposing disclosure display requirements more stringent than federal requirements when federal law or rule is applicable. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. We're going to stand at recess for a moment. Joe, got a moment? Step outside with me. We're hearing House Bill 2957, and the chair would like to call Joe Gilliam.
Can I bring a cohort with me?
The amendment's here. Welcome, Joe, and who's that with you today? As if I don't know.
Go ahead.
Welcome to you both for the record.
Good afternoon.
Are you okay? Let me go ahead and introduce the bill and the amendments.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. For the record, my name is Joe Gilliam, representing the Oregon Grocery Association. The bill you have before you, what we wanted to address was the Dash 1 amendments. After spending some time talking to legislative council, we came back around to some language that was a bit cleaner and would comply with federal concerns on how the original bill was introduced. The two main things we're getting at here in the process of labeling food, which is incredibly important to the food supply, is that the issue of labeling, everything needs to be accurate and relevant on the label. And the other thing is uniformity, and it needs to be cost efficient, because there's a whole issue of delivery to the consumer and efficient, cost-effective delivery. And we don't believe that there should be any labeling standard that impedes that commerce, but we do believe strongly that people have a right to know what's in their food. But it is very important that whatever label goes on a package, and we're not anti-labeling, but whatever goes on there has gone through a process to be screened, to be reviewed, to be determined if it's scientifically valid, it's based in science, that there's a reason for it to be on the label. And a federal standard is it would be the best of all conditions that our food would be labeled for health reasons and standard reasons. This comes from federal government, so all states would have the same requirements, and the distribution would be okay through all the states. So this bill does two things. The first is to first not have local governments impose labeling requirements. That destroys the food distribution chain and is very difficult to deliver food. I mean, it would literally take some food off the shelf because they wouldn't make a Lane County-only package or a Lakeview-only jam or something like that. They couldn't do it. And so this says, let's keep everything, all the discussion of labels, at least at the state level. Then it goes to the next step and says that any existing labels would not be any more stringent than the federal labels in order to try to keep that federal standard and keep the food process moving. It's important not only to the grocery stores and the food processing chain, but wholesalers and all that, but it's also important to the growers and food manufacturers who are stationed or who are headquartered here, watching too much CNN, who are headquartered here in the state of Oregon, that they're not at a competitive disadvantage and that they're not under labeling requirements that other states, other jurisdictions don't recognize, and therefore their product becomes undesirable because it's not based in science. That doesn't have good information, and then people say, well, I'll buy it from somebody else from another state. So that's what the bill does. Just in the Dash 1 amendments does those two things, the local preemption of labeling laws and then also the federal standards.
Okay. Gene, welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Gene Underhill-Wilkinson, Associate Director with Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Oregon Farm Bureau, along with Oregonians for Food and Shelter, prepared some testimony today. Terry Witt with Oregonians for Food and Shelter is usually the leading person representing our interests on food labeling issues. So I'm just going to review the testimony that he has prepared and we concur with today. And it's some of the same points that Joe has just pointed out. Uniform food labeling is critical to Oregon's agriculture economy and is of significance to both food suppliers and the consuming public. From the supplier's perspective, as you've heard, uniform labels that are consistent with federal agency standards ensures a free flow of products between all 50 states and within our state. Non-uniform labeling requirements would add cost to food packaging, warehousing, and distribution operations. This increased cost would have a negative impact on Oregon's agriculture community, since more than 80% of our farm products are exported outside the state. Unnecessarily labeling costs would also adversely impact the end consumer, since these costs ultimately result in higher food prices. Label information that conforms to federal standards, as Joe pointed out, will ensure that consumers receive information that's deemed useful by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, rather than misleading or unsubstantiated claims. This ensures that required food label information on a product grown, processed, or sold in Oregon will be identical to that required on the label somewhere else. Such uniformity provides a level, consistently enforced playing field on both the supplier and consumer levels, and it gives the consumer the ability to have meaningful comparisons in buying their products. So again, we urge you to support House Bill 2957. Additional costs on the agriculture community would cause suffering to the economy of the state with unnecessary food labeling. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think the most vivid example is the FDA letter that we attached to the back of my testimony, highlighting their feelings towards Measure 27 is a good example, where that issue is the GMO issue was included in the organic labeling process, but it was done through a federal standard, and everyone has the same set of rules. Measure 27, they actually opposed Measure 27 because it just absolutely upset the apple cart, and the claims that were made in Measure 27 just had not been reviewed to be for safety or for health, or that they're based in science. And it's okay to put it on the front of the package if that's a marketing tool and people that don't want GMO foods to buy your product, but it's not something for the back of the label that should be all based in science and be accurate information.
All right. Thank you both very much. Questions, members?
Can I start over for Representative Gilman?
We'll go through it all again.
No, I don't think so. Representative Gilman can always listen to the tapes.
Yeah.
Representative Hunt, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the dash one, I completely understand section 1-1 in terms of the preemption. In terms of subsection 2, I understand where that, what the prohibition that would have on a state agency. I mean, I assume the legislature can come back at any point statutorily and change this and decide to impose to make a change and impose a standard. Really, the only preemptions are on the state agencies and on local governments, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, that is true. It would, you know, in a practical matter, if you were to pass an initiative and say there's a label and you have to go out and enforce a new label, someone would have to enforce it to be a state agency. So there would have to be, you know, the issue, we would believe that they would come under compliance, that they couldn't do a local label or one that was more federally stringent. Now, in any law, legislature can change the law at any time and say, well, we're no longer going to do that, so this year we're going to do something else. So it's only as strong as to the next legislature.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in, you kind of represent two different ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you give me a sense for either of your members, maybe what percentage of your members, for your members, I mean, do you have any members that get all of their food from within the county that they happen to be located in?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. That food comes from all over the United States that we distribute. And so I represent also food manufacturing, wholesaling, and retail, the whole chain of that. And there's nothing that would just come from one county or one city, even our state, much less our state. Measure 27 posed huge problems because we are a small market in terms of the nation. Our 3.5 million people is a very small market. At some point, people say, well, it's not worth the cost of doing an Oregon-only package, and it would only get worse as you work yourself down to your local PUD or something.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up one more time. Gene, I guess at the other end of the spectrum, do you have any members who provide all of their product just within the city or county they're located in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I doubt it. Maybe a very small amount is grown on the farm and sold at fruit stands and potentially consumed right in the local jurisdiction. But most of all, the farm products are distributed out of the local jurisdiction, you know, in a broad span. And also the foods that are consumed within a local jurisdiction come from a broad span on a worldwide basis. So, again, a local jurisdiction implementing food labeling just within that jurisdiction can cause unnecessary expense and a lot of confusion for everybody throughout the food chain.
Members, additional questions? Hearing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Chair. Chair would like to call Richard North. Richard? And Richard, do you have anyone else with you today to testify?
There may be others testifying.
Okay.
I'm not sure if they're doing anything.
Well, there's a couple more people on the list, so. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming today. And when each one of you speak, be sure to state your name clearly for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Richard North. I'm from Durham, Oregon. And I want to say I'm here in opposition to Bill 2957. The advocates may be well-intentioned in putting forth this bill. However, I think it would be a major mistake to enter this into law. If you take a look at subsection 1, which preempts a local government from imposing food labeling requirements, there is no evidence, and I've been studying this issue quite intensively for the past 2 years, I cannot find any evidence of any local government that has ever instituted a mandate to label food. Portland had an attempt. There was a petition put in for an initiative back in 2000 to label genetically engineered foods. It never got anywhere. They had to collect around 25,000 signatures. They didn't even come close. It never was even an issue. I don't know of any, again, government, local, town, anywhere in the country that's even tried this. This is kind of like asking scientists to develop a vaccine for an illness that doesn't even exist. This is a legislative situation that does not exist. In the very real sense of the phrase, this seems to be a solution in search of a problem. And I think with all the really serious issues facing all of you in the legislature this year, that this is a waste of time and money to even be bringing this up. That's section one, subsection one. Subsection two, the underlying assumption here, this is to not allow any state food labeling laws more stringent than federal requirements. The underlying assumption is that the federal government is always going to be the fount of wisdom on the labeling laws for people in the United States. History has shown that this is absolutely not true. The labeling requirements instituted by the federal government have been and still are very much involved with political decisions. As the best example I can give you, let's take the FDA. When the FDA, and let's take genetically engineered foods, when the FDA came to its conclusion that genetically engineered plants are substantially equivalent to non-genetically engineered plants, this was back in 1992, they overrode the decision of their own scientists. The administrators overrode the decision of their own scientists to make this determination. This is not just my opinion. This is a matter of public record. And you can view the very letters of their scientists saying that they thought genetically engineered foods posed different risks than non-genetically engineered foods. If you take a look at the second page of my testimony, the page stapled to it, you can see this was one of the most controversial decisions the FDA has ever made, and it has been soundly criticized by scientists, physicians, government leaders, and lay people, not only in the United States, but around the world. Let me give you an example. Here's a quart of milk. I bought it at Safeway last fall. Okay? There is nothing on here. There is no label that would indicate what may very well be in this milk. And what I'm referring to is a substance that the FDA has approved called recombinant bovine growth hormone. And what this does, farmers have injected this into their cows to increase the production of milk by around 10 to 20%. That's the intended effect, and it works. The unintended effects. It increases the incidence of mastitis in the cows. It hurts them. It gives them infections. Not all of them, but more than would if they didn't get this stuff. It gives them infections so that the farmers then have to treat the cows with more antibiotics. When these antibiotics get in the milk and get into humans, they may very well increase the antibiotic resistance that we have. This is a very, very serious medical issue. That's one big problem. The other big problem is that RBGH, bovine growth hormone, recombinant bovine growth hormone, genetically engineered, increases the production of a protein called IGF-1. IGF-1 has been linked, correlated, with higher rates of breast cancer, prostate cancer, and colon cancer. Okay? I don't want to overstate the case. There hasn't been an absolute causative relationship proved yet. But there are so many questions about the known and unknown risks of RBGH that nearly every industrialized country in the world has banned the use of it. They've gone beyond labeling. They've banned it. And they consider that what the United States is doing with this substance is basically using our own population as guinea pigs on whether this is safe. On a personal note, how I even ended up here, I was doing research for a program we were doing at our church on food, and I ran across this information. I couldn't believe it. I show it to my wife. My wife has two sisters who already have had breast cancer. So genetically, she is most likely at risk, at a higher risk for breast cancer, as is my daughter. Okay? I can assure you that was the last day that we ever bought milk that we didn't know did not have RBGH. From the FDA's rules, from any milk you get like this, you will never know if it's got it or not. Another food issue, this is not genetically related. I'd like to ask all of you up there on the bench there, if you got a pound of hamburger and it had a label on it which said pasteurized, would you know what it meant? I know you normally think of pasteurization in terms of milk. Would any of you know what that meant? Okay, there are seven of you up there that you're not stupid at all. Last year, Congress directed the FDA to allow meat that had been irradiated to have the label pasteurized. You know why they did this? The main reason they did this is because Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, he was the chair of the Senate Agricultural Committee, he was the one that came up with this idea, and it went through. Iowa just happens to have the largest irradiation plant for ground beef in the country. I don't think this is a coincidence. And I think it's an excellent example of how politics plays a role in what happens with federal food labeling. And there's a perfect example of how this labeling at a federal level does not clarify the issue, it confuses it. One other point. This is some good news. Many states are now taking things into their own hands. New Mexico, their state is looking at studying food labeling right now, genetically engineered. Maine, next Monday, the very same committee that this is, they're going to be looking at a 3-year moratorium on genetically engineered foods. Maryland has already banned genetically engineered fish from any waterway that goes into the Chesapeake Bay, knowing how dangerous that can be. And Vermont. Vermont now has 70 towns, 70, okay, that have passed resolutions supporting labeling and or moratoriums or regulation on genetically engineered foods. Okay? They've had a series of meetings. What they've done, they brought in farmers. They brought in, and they've got their own, their scientists, their doctors, their educators, and they've had discussions on genetically engineered food. And as so often happens, the more the people know about it, the more concerned they get. And the more they realize from a lot of different perspectives how dangerous it can really be and how the federal government, in its lack of labeling, has not sufficiently protected us. I'd like to show you a map. This is a map of Vermont. And on it, you're going to see a lot of shaded townships. These are the townships that have passed these resolutions. And what this has led to now in the Vermont State Legislature are no fewer than 9 different bills dealing with the registration and liability and labeling and even all the way to a moratorium of genetically engineered foods. This, to me, is what democracy looks like. And this is not saying that people in Vermont are any better or smarter or than we are, and they have their own set of problems and disagreements. But what they've done is they've taken this issue head on. This bill not only restricts the right to know of our citizens, it even goes beyond that. It's even worse. It restricts the right to act, if we so wish. What is the purpose of tying our own hands? Who benefits? It is certainly not consumers, and it's certainly not who are all our consumers, certainly not the citizens of our state. So I'm asking you, please vote no on House Bill 2957. And thank you for your time. And afterwards, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ma'am, state your name for the record, please.
Yes, so my name is Mafe Chase. I'm from Portland, Oregon. And I'm here to oppose the bill. Looking at your bill, it's quite comical, really, to see on the line there, you say, being enacted by the people of the state of Oregon, and the word people is capitalized. Then later in the bill, you impose restrictions on the people of Oregon that we will never do to ourselves. One is that, why will the people of Oregon limit themselves on the right to know what is in their food? And why will the people of Oregon give up their rights to control their own labeling to the federal government? We have known that the federal government, or specifically the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA, has not done its job in protecting the public against specifically genetically engineered food. As experience with, if you know the issue on the Starling corn fiasco a few years ago, this Starling corn was not intended for human consumption, but eventually found its way to our food supply, including our taco shells, our corn chips, to name a few. This incident simply showed that the FDA or the USDA needs to do its job in protecting the consumers. Until now, there are recent reports that the Starling corn can still be traced in a lot of the corn, especially when they exported corn to Japan. They still found traces of Starling corn, even though the USDA themselves found it shocking to know that this Starling corn is still contaminating the corn. And they thought that a few years year ago it has already eradicated, they totally clean it up. That's just one example. And also, the U.S. government's policies on genetic engineering and industrial agriculture is still under fire as never been before, from Iowa to India, from London to Latin America. Recent reports show that a lot of countries are not accepting this genetically engineered food, and it has really affected the export of our local farmers and our agriculture. I believe that the American public, especially Oregonians, have the right to know what's in their food, and the public opinion is vital. I cannot really quote, but I believe there's 80% of Americans wants their food to be labeled. And opinions around the world continues to be skeptical towards genetically modified crops, and particularly GM foods, seeing them as having little value and dangerous for society. I also would like to specifically take an example, just like the African nations. They are already a starving nation, and I came from a third world country too, from the Philippines, and I find that even the starving people of Africa don't want to accept genetically modified corn because they know that there will be an effect in their environment as well as in their health. To name a few health effects of genetically engineered organism, there will be an introduction of toxins into our food, there will be a spread of antibiotic resistance, new diseases will come up, and the introduction of allergens, as well as the increased risk of cancers. Environmental impacts of this are irreversible, and the impacts on non-target organism will also be well hidden. And also there will be the sprouting out of super weeds and super pests. To conclude my testimony, I think this bill was written on behalf or even by corporations operating in the state of Oregon, most likely in direct opposition to the real interests of the state's people. Really, if you want to make a bill regarding labeling and attribute it to the people of the state of Oregon specifically, you will require labeling of products containing transgenic organisms, or better yet, you will ban their use in our foods. And I would like also to add to what Rick said about other states and other cities that are already have a moratorium or have introduced labeling in the state senate or in their local councils. I can name a few in California, Nebraska, Vermont, Minnesota, Michigan, West Virginia, Maryland, New York, Berkeley, and in Boston. These are the few states and cities that have introduced labeling laws. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record,
my name is Jim Feldman, and I live in Portland, Oregon. Chairman Kropp and members of the committee, it's the first time I've ever done this. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm happy to have a chance to talk to you. I believe that
you
really
say you came from Chicago for this?
Originally, yeah.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, right. I did. I got involved in this in 1999, I believe. I heard someone speak on this issue, and it pretty much knocked me off my feet, and it led to a complete change in terms of what I do. And so, yeah. And Portland's a place to be for this type of work, for progressive work. And that's why I feel so strongly that we really don't want to be tying our hands and limiting ourselves in terms of what legislations we can pass and what legislations we can't pass. When I heard the people that, I'm in opposition to this bill. When I heard the people speaking in support of this bill, you may have seen this movie before with John Candy when they're heading down the highway, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and they're going the wrong way down the highway. And they don't know it, and the people going this way are waving to them saying, you're going the wrong way, you're going the wrong way, and they don't know, and they're happily driving on the wrong way, the expressway, and next thing you know, they go between these two big semis, and you know, and then it's comical beyond there. But the point is, this bill is going the wrong way. It's going the wrong way. It's going the wrong way in terms of democracy, and it's going the wrong way in terms of disclosure. We need to be open about what we're doing to our food. This is radical stuff we're doing. We've never done this before. We've never spliced together lightning bugs and tobacco. You know, we're doing that now. We've never spliced together hormones from human beings and DNA from cows. This is all new and novel technology that needs to be on the front of the label and needs to be on the back of the label, and it needs to be forefront in our minds. We don't know what this technology is going to do. So to illustrate this point, I'll make three examples, and then I think from that you'll be able to see that this is really different technology. In spite of what the industry tells you, it's a very different technology. So the first example you've already heard is the Starling corn example. The industry tells you that this is, the genetically engineered corn is the same, but you probably heard about Starling corn and that got into the human food chain. You heard about that? Do folks remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was a big deal. We were called Taco Bell taco shells, and it cost us millions of dollars. Japan sent back our corn. So did a number of other countries. So did Korea. Well, it was in over 300 products. And basically, and this, to me, shows how this corn is different from other corn. So this Starling corn needed 300-foot containment fields around the corn itself. Okay? Normal corn doesn't need that. You don't need to have 300-foot containment fields around your corn. You plant your corn, you harvest your corn, and you turn it into products. You don't need containment fields. This is an example of how this corn is fundamentally different than other corn. Another example is that, well, it wasn't supposed to be eaten by human beings. It's another great example of how this corn is fundamentally different than other corn. So when you hear people from industry, when you hear people from the biotech industry specifically telling you, hey, this corn's the same, weigh it with those lenses. Ask yourself, is that the same? If we have to put containment fields around our corn, is that the same as other corn? It's not. I don't believe that it is. Another example is the GE salmon. Have you heard of this one? It was mentioned, it was alluded to here. These salmon, they can't be released in the wild. They're designed to grow faster, 13 times as large and 6 times as fast as regular salmon. And they're one of the makers is called Aqua Advantage. That's their claim of how the fish work. So they blow up like a marshmallow in the microwave, right? They grow real fast, and then we can sell them and be able to make up for the salmon we've depleted in the oceans already. But the disadvantage is because they're bigger and they grow faster, they have less survival skills in the wild. Okay, so they aren't going to survive in the wild if they get out there. Not only that, because they're bigger, they're selected through natural selection more frequently. So those genes get bred into the gene pool more readily because they're bigger fish. So we breed in an inability to survive in the wild through this fish that's exactly the same as other fish. Does that sound the same to you? Doesn't sound the same to me. And this is why there are states saying, no, we don't want this fish in the wild. And not only that, we ban this fish in the wild. And there are people saying, no, we don't want this fish. We like salmon. We'd like to see it be around for another 100 years, as opposed to snuffed out on some scheme to make super salmon, Franken salmon. So that's another example of how these foods are fundamentally different. The last case Rick touched on is RBGH milk. Can you believe that we're drinking milk? If you're drinking a latte today, if you give your child milk products, you know, that chocolate milkshake or whatever, that there's RBGH in there. And that particular hormone is banned in every other industrialized country. That pretty much, for me, I'm sitting there asking myself, why are we using it and no one else is using it? Okay? And those are the questions I believe that this committee can ask themselves. Why are we using it then? If it's banned in almost every other industrialized country, why does the United States feel they need to use it? Are we running out of milk? Is there a shortage of milk in this country? No, the answer is no. We're actually pouring milk down the drain right now. We aren't using all our milk. So why are we producing more of it more cheaply? I think if the members of this committee search that answer out, they'll find some interesting answers and begin to bring this debate into a different focus. I want to give you a quick quote here. So in 1999, the UN Food Safety Agency upholded the EU's ban on RBGH. Okay? So this isn't just a couple of people coming to you here to testify and say RBGH is bad. What happened here in 1999, the UN Food Safety Agency held up the EU's ban on this chemical. So these are large bodies of scientists, large governmental bodies saying no. No, we don't want this chemical in our milk. And by restricting Oregonians' rights to label and to force disclosure of these chemicals, you're restricting Oregonians' right to choose whether or not they want to consume this food. It's bad enough that it's legal to even sell it, but here we don't even have the right to choose if we want it or not. And it's been said sometimes, and I'll end at this, that people that don't want this food can simply buy organic and avoid it that way. Just buy the USDA label and you can buy it that, you know, you can avoid the food that way. That's simply not true. It's simply not a valid method of avoiding this food. Because this food, it's like pollution with legs, see? Just like you need 300-foot containment fields around Starling corn because it cross-pollinates, it applies to all these crops. So the corn that was genetically engineered to contain this Starling, you know, this special Starling DNA, is now in the organic too. And you may have seen the New York Times article that talked about this, that even if you're buying organic corn now, you're still getting trace amounts of genetically engineered DNA because of this cross-pollination. So the original crop, you know, the mythical crop we were given when we came over here, quote unquote, on the Mayflower, and we landed, and the indigenous people gave us corn, we've just given it back to them. We've polluted it. It's done. We've polluted basically the corn crops all the way across this country. And you may have heard back in April last year when they found that the Starling corn and genetically engineered corn was down in Mexico, which is the birthplace of corn. So we went ahead and took care of their corn, too. And it was banned from Mexico, by the way. But the pollen drift and the seeds that transferred down there got the corn, the genetically engineered corn down there as well. We're playing with fire, ladies and gentlemen. I think that there's somewhere inside you that senses this. This is not the same as other food. And we're going the wrong way. So I ask the Agriculture Committee to pay attention and wake up to the changes that are happening and protect the people and give them the right to choose and do the due diligence to find out what is in their best interest. And I'm open to questions. Thank you.
Okay. Members' questions. Mr. Gilman.
Because of a little history of dairy farming, RBGH, it's a great enhancer of milk production. My question, and you mentioned it a bit, is organic. I happen to have a neighbor that produces organic milk. He buys organic feeds. He doesn't use antibiotics. I wonder why that isn't an answer to the question. Of course, you pay about... He's getting about a fourth more, so you're going to pay about a fourth more probably, too. But those of you that feel... I'm not convinced this is a bad production enhancer. But if it is, and you're convinced it is, why not just organic?
If I can answer that question. Two reasons. One, not everything in terms of whether it's, say, if you used our RBGH and your neighbor did not, some things, especially crops like corn and canola, readily pollinate. In this particular case, I don't see your milk production contaminating your neighbor's milk production, okay? So there are differences in crops. Second, in terms of why not buy organic, we've got to ask ourselves, who's representing the consumer here? Not all consumers in Oregon can even find organic food. And for those people who can't find it, just as you mentioned, Representative Gilman, not everybody can afford it. Who's looking out for the consumer here? Okay, in Portland, we're lucky enough, there happens to be some milk we can get in Portland. It's not organic. It's also labeled not to use RBGH, and it's cheaper than organic. It happens to be what we buy. And I want to make sure we're on the same point here. When this shocked me about RBGH, one thing I didn't mention, I worked for the American Cancer Society for 21 years. Okay? The last six, I was CEO of the Oregon Division, and I'd never even heard of this stuff. Okay? You may or may not agree with the concerns that we have about genetically engineered foods, in addition, concerns I have about non-genetically engineered foods and the way that they're processed. You may or may not agree, and that's certainly up to you. But let's not miss the main point here. The main point of this bill is to take away our right to even discuss whether we should exceed the federal standards. And not only take away our right to discuss it, our right to take action on it. Okay? That is the main point of this bill. And in those discussions, just like they're having in Vermont, just like you've got, they mentioned farmers here, there are virtually no farmers in the entire state of Oregon that even grow genetically engineered crops. Okay? But you've got hundreds of farmers in Vermont right now that are pushing for labeling and some for a moratorium. And they're seeing it as an economic enhancement for what they can sell their crops for. Because they know that so many people do not want these things. They see it as an economic advantage. So that's what this bill is about. It is about our democratic rights as Oregonians.
Just a quick follow-up. You mentioned that no communities in Oregon were working on this proposal, so you didn't think that you thought this was a solution in search of a problem. But then you go on to say that in Vermont there are communities that have already said they must have labeling.
Okay. Let me clarify that. The communities in the first place, there have been no communities, local communities, city, town, county, that have ever passed legislation mandating food labeling that I know of. If anybody can produce evidence to the contrary, I'd love to see it.
Are you talking about in Oregon, sir?
I'm talking about in Oregon, okay. In Vermont, what the towns are doing, they are voting on resolutions, okay, in favor of liability, registration, labeling, and moratorium. Okay? When they're talking about labeling, a township in Vermont can say, we favor labeling. They're talking about labeling at the state level, not the local level.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious. I'm searching for your names. I have them here somewhere.
This is Mr. North.
Mr. North and Macho?
Mafe.
Sorry.
Chase.
Ms. Chase. And Mr.
Feldman.
Your purpose for being here today is what do you want? I guess I'm trying. Other than saying no, what is it you do want?
I want the opportunity for all Oregonians to be able to discuss these issues without having, well, basically what we have now, we have from the federal government in terms of food labeling, we have a floor. Okay? What this bill is trying to do is turn that floor into a ceiling that we cannot go beyond. And I'm asking all of you, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to cut off any further discussion, any further input from the residents of Oregon on whether they want to go beyond the federal standards? To me, that's just, it's taking away our right to know and our right to act. That's why I'm here.
Well, Mr. North, we'll follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. I just wonder what it is. Are you protesting that we live by a federal code right now by the USDA and the FDA? I mean, is that the issue? Because you have the right to question. You can go, you know, you could come ask us how we raise potatoes, and I'll tell you. Hmm. But, I mean, you have the right. So I'm not sure what, do you think this bill does not restrict your right to ask in any form or any human being? What it simply does is it allows the current marketing to conform to one set standard. If you don't like that standard, I mean, there's nothing that keeps you from, in the future, asking for the FDA and the USDA to make other changes to give you additional information. I want to be sure that you're not thinking that this is restricting your ability to, you know, like this is, you know, finite life. I mean, we're done. Or
no.
Infinite life, I guess.
No, of course not. No, I know that there can be changes made at the federal level. And I'm not totally opposed to the USDA, FDA. You know, as a matter of fact, my own brother works for the FDA, okay? He's a good guy. He did good work. And a lot of people that he worked with did very good work, okay? And I sympathize in many ways because they're vastly underfunded and don't have enough staff to do what they're asked to do. So this is not a general criticism of the FDA. But all that notwithstanding, in many, many areas, I cited two of them, okay, the FDA simply is not providing proper information and proper protection for the people of the United States. And
Mr. North, my follow-up is, have you gone to the FDA, and like you're testifying here, and asked them to make that change? I'm not sure we as a committee here can change the FDA and the USDA. We can get a memorial
and
ask them to look into things, but have you gone forth or with our representatives to ask them to make these changes?
Representative Nelson, we need to do a reality check here, okay? Our chances, I can try, you know. Yes, absolutely. We could go to our representatives and our senators and ask them to change. The fact is there are so many politics going on at the FDA and USDA with their agencies that it is nearly impossible. There have been attempts to change this. There was a lawsuit against the FDA in 1999 to try to get them to reverse their stance. The genetically engineered foods were, quote, substantially equivalent to non-genetically engineered foods. That is in that lawsuit where it came out that the FDA overrode their own scientists. So the chances that I have of getting, you know, or any individuals here of getting things changed at the federal level are slim and none. The chances that we have at a state level are significantly better, and that's why I don't want to take away the right of the citizens of this state to discuss and make additional labels if we see fit. If we don't see fit, fine. But at least allow us the chance to have the debate.
Hmm. Last follow-up, Mr. Chair. All I wanted to state is that you may do that. You may do that forever, you know, as long as this legislature is here. You may come present a bill and say, you know, I'd like to promote that the bills tell us whatever this is in our ground beef, or I want a bill that says this stuff is in our milk. You may do that at any time. This bill does not preempt you from doing that in any form.
Well, it appears to me...
It doesn't.
Okay.
And if you read the statute here, you know, 616, you'll see that. I mean...
Representative Nelson.
You have a lot of protection to do this. And having been a farmer, you know, I really understand this.
With,
I'm just saying, you know,
okay.
You have that wrong.
With the wording on this bill, okay, because with the wording on this bill, between Tuesday's session and today, myself and somebody I know checked with three different lawyers on the wording of this bill. I'm talking specifically Section 2. They weren't even sure what it meant. They weren't even sure if this, what this allowed and what it didn't allow. So there appears to be a significant amount of confusion on what this bill even means. But from my reading of it as a layperson, what it means to me is that this preempts any attempt on a statewide level of labeling food, any kind of food, beyond what the federal government labels. That's what it says to me.
Richard, I think the point that Representative Nelson is trying to make is that the wording of this is statutory in nature. And what the point she's trying to make to you is this does not take away your right to contact any member of this committee or your representative or senator and ask them to introduce legislation to reverse this, should it become law, or to impose any other type of a labeling requirement that you think is necessary. The process for you as a citizen in the state of Oregon is still in place, irrespective of what this says. You can try to influence and change the process as a person of interest in the public. Nothing here is taking away your right to discuss the issue. Nothing in this is taking away, as I read it, your right to litigate on this issue for that matter. So I think I would encourage you to consider that you still have the right to introduce legislation through a representative to change this or preempt this, in effect, if you desire, at any time in the future.
Chairman Krupp, the way I'm reading, I understand that, yes, I have the right to discuss it. Yes, I could talk with anybody in the state. I understand all that.
Okay.
What's maybe I'm not clear on is that I don't, Section 1 to me is unnecessary, totally unnecessary. Section 2 is totally undemocratic in that it does preempt any further labeling. So if this becomes law, to me, that is a bad law. Okay, there would be no further discussion, and then you'd have to go and reverse this.
Right.
That seems like an awful lot of work to me, when I don't think this should become a law in the first place.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hunt, you have a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm interested, Mr. North. Can you share with us where, in terms of that milk, maybe the city in which you purchased it and the city where it was
produced? Yeah, I bought this Safeway right outside of Durham.
And maybe the city where it was produced.
Oh, and produced. Distributed by Safeway, Pleasanton, California. It doesn't. That's where it's distributed. I'm not sure where it was produced.
If I might,
sure.
Follow, Mr. Chair, and I'll confess, part of my perspective comes from 10 years of working for Congress, and. You know, seeing a lot of these issues from the federal perspective, I guess I'm interested, and I would be the first to acknowledge FDA may need to be changed, may need to do a better job, may well be understaffed. But if you don't see FDA or some federal agency being the arbiter, I mean, do you see a committee like this being the arbiter of what's safe or not? Do you see a Board of County Commissioners, the City Council? Who do you see being the arbiter of what is safe or not?
Right.
If it can't be done effectively by an agency that's just filled with biologists and other scientific experts?
I see this very appropriately at the state level. And it's not that you have to be a scientist. You have to be a biologist. I'm neither. Okay? But you can certainly bring in, and this is exactly what Vermont and Maine have done. They bring in farmers. They bring in scientists. They bring in doctors. They bring in all kinds of people to share their knowledge and allow the people of those states to make their decisions. And if the people in those states, this is going on right now. I'm not sure why, if they can't do it, why can't we? Why do we have to accept something less in terms of the democratic process than other states in this country? Maryland's already done it at a state level with genetically engineered fish. So if they can do it, why can't Oregon? You know, it's maybe the same kind of principle. It's a different subject. But Oregon passed the beach bill. Okay? We kept our beaches open for everybody to use. Not all states did that, and the federal government certainly didn't do it. Oregon produced the bottle bill. That wasn't the federal government saying that. We went past what the federal government did, and we did something that most people in the state think was a really great thing to do. That's where there was a floor, and we went beyond it. So I guess my question again is, why? Why would the state of Oregon want to take a floor and turn it into a ceiling? It does not make any sense to me.
Yes, if I could follow up one more question. So would you be supportive of having some kind of an agency at the state level that would basically come in where we would basically create our own little mini FDA that would be the nexus of all these scientists and biologists and be able to sign off on, or the local level for that matter?
Local level, no. I do not see the feasibility of labeling food at a local level. So in terms of the intent, I completely agree with that. But the fact is it just doesn't happen anyway, so it's not even an issue. At the state level, I see no reason to create another agency to increase bureaucracy. I'm a cheapskate, okay? I pinch pennies, and I expect government to do the same thing and use my tax dollars wisely, okay? But if a current agency responding to, such as the Department of Agriculture, whoever, responding to the wishes of the people in this state, just like they've done in other states, wishes to do that, then they should be free to do it. This preempts their ability to do it.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2957? Hearing none, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2957 and open a work session on House Bill 2957.
Mr. Yeah. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I want to be sure, if I could please, there is just the dash one amendment. I kept hearing someone speak of dash two.
No, so the only amendment we have is the dash one.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2957.
Members of the dash, it has been moved that we adopt the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2957. Discussion? Hearing none. Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
I move House Bill 2957 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Members, it's been moved House Bill 2957 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, is there any objection?
Yes.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative Warren?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Chair Crum.
Aye. House Bill 2957 is hereby passed to the House with a due pass recommendation as amended, and the chair will carry the bill. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2957, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3152. Members, I intend to move through this bill relatively quickly, and then I would like to get into our last two bills, which are companion bills that we would like to hear together on the same subject. So with that, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3152. Ray?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3152 directs the State Forestry Department to enter into long-term stewardship contracts to provide forest fire fuel elimination services and forest health programs within state forests. It specifies elements of the contracts and directs the department to adopt rules. It also directs the court to consider certain evidence and challenges to eliminate, or to eliminate two elements of the contract. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ray. Ross Holloway. Ross, come forward, and shall we have Jim Ness from the Judicial Department come at the same time? Why don't we do that? Welcome.
Welcome.
For the record, state your name.
Good afternoon, Chair Krupp, members of the committee. My name is Ross Holloway. I'm the State Forest Program Director for the Oregon Department of Forestry. And the department appreciates this opportunity to provide testimony with regards to the House Bill 3152. And I will keep my comments fairly brief and just summarize what's in the written testimony that you're receiving. The department supports the principles and goals that are described in the bill. We do have some concerns about the specific methods required in the bill to achieve those goals. Both the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry are committed to protecting and restoring and maintaining the health of Oregon's forests. And to that end, I think the board and the department have a reputation for promoting management to create forests that are not only resilient to natural disturbances, but are also resilient to catastrophic losses from forest resources, from wildfire, insects, and disease. And not only does the department promote these principles for all forest lands in the state, but we also apply these to the management of state forests. And we manage about 789,000 acres of state forests, mostly in western Oregon, but also some in the Klamath Basin. And just as an example of how we apply those principles to our Sun Pass State Forest in the Klamath Basin, for many years we've been managing there with uneven age management designed to restore forest health and to reduce the risk of catastrophic fire, and essentially do that through uneven age management. And over the past 10 years alone, we've done fuel reduction work and forest health work on about 12,000 acres of the Sun Pass State Forest, which is over a third of the forest land that we manage in Klamath County. We do that primarily through timber sale contracts, where we have the purchaser go through a series of operations where they not only remove merchantable timber, which produces revenue for the counties and the Common School Fund, but also remove excess understory trees and shrubs and essentially reduce the overall fuel loading on the site. And the timber sale purchasers generally subcontract with woods workers in the communities. The loggers do some of the work. Some of the reforestation companies do the work. But essentially, the work gets done at quite an active scale under the existing plan we have in place and the existing policies. So in summary, the department supports a policy of active management to address the forest health concerns and to manage forest fuels and the associated fire risks, which appear to be the goals of the bill before you. We already aggressively pursue this type of management on state forest lands managed by the Department of Forestry. And the provisions of the current bill would really not change what we're doing on the ground, but would change some of the mechanisms that we would have to use to accomplish it. So we support working with the staff to develop some amendments to the bill that would retain the policy direction, but perhaps broaden out the methods that we can use to accomplish that end of forest health and reduced fire risk. So with that, I thank you again for the opportunity to testify. I'd be glad to answer any questions about state forest management.
Thank you, Ross. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Holloway, I can get really mad about this subject, so I'm going to be really nice because I like you.
We appreciate that, Representative.
But why are we wasting so much of our resources by being so dilatory to do what is prudent and right? I mean, these things are making me crazy. I mean, we know the fire season from last year. I just want to know, are your hands tied by some bureaucratic policy that prevents you from doing what's prudent and right in your position?
Representative Nelson, Chair Krupp. No, I don't believe they are. As I pointed out and discussed, we do this kind of work regularly on state forest lands. We have not used long-term stewardship contracts as a tool. We've generally used shorter-term contracts with reforestation contractors, other woods workers, and our own timber sale contracts. We look at it as an integrated operation where we're actually generating revenue and making money and reducing the fuel at the same time. And we consider that a very efficient way to go about the business of achieving the goals that I think this bill seeks to achieve. And so,
So what you're saying, Ross, is you pretty much do this on state lands anyway.
We do this on state forest lands, and there's more work to do. I mean, we do it at a pace.
But clearly, the federal government is very much a different issue, is it not?
I would agree that it is. And they own a lot more acres in the state, and so it's a much wider spread problem on those lands than it is on state forest lands.
Just a last thought. I just want, you know, I respect so much what you do, and but you know, we ought to be thanking God right now that it's been raining. And I recall, I mean, one year as early as February, the forest fire started, and in our company we, you know, responded and supported y'all tremendously. But it just seems like we're just asking for it, you know. Reminds me of leaving matches around for my grandchildren to play with, you know, when they're out in the where I've got stashes of trash, you know, from trying to clean out my flower beds and things. And we're leaving all this here, and instead of jump-starting, you know, the economy by doing what's right and protecting our resources, we just have to stay at this snail's pace. that doesn't clean up our forests the way and truly, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
Representative Nelson, Chair Krupp, I do. And I agree that in widespread on a statewide basis, there's a problem with forest fuel accumulation, particularly in eastern and southern Oregon, due to fire exclusion. I don't believe that problem exists at a large scale on state forest lands because of the way we have actively managed them for years in recognition of exactly the kind of problem that we do see on other lands in the state. Thank you.
Further questions? Okay, James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Nass, legal counsel for the appellate courts. We have no view on the merits of the bill. Our focus is solely on the judicial review sections of the bill, particularly subsection 4 of section 1 of the bill, would require the courts on judicial review to consider certain evidence. Our concern is that unless that evidence is already in the record, what is it that we're going to review? Some of these cases may end up in circuit courts, and if indeed it's if it is judicial review of an order and other than a contested case, the circuit court under current law may take evidence. But if the case comes directly to the Court of Appeals, we are not a evidence-taking court. We have no mechanism for doing that. But I think there's an easy fix to it. At the bottom of the first page, I think if you take that sentence, which is in essence I think what subsection 4 says, make it the second sentence of section 1, it will in effect require the Forestry Department up front to assess the risk of fire and the benefit that the contract will reduce that risk. And then once the Forestry Department does that, then on judicial review, we will have all the evidence that we need to review. I would point out, though, that with respect to a circuit court taking evidence, there is a bill, Senate Bill 100, that would bar the circuit court from taking evidence and would require remand to the agency to do that. So if this bill passes in this form, there will be, and I think that bill has moved out of the Senate, there will need to be some sort of reconciliation with Senate Bill 100 and this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes. I'm glad you're here. Last season, I thought, when we're a government entity and we have this kind of protection, this immunity from lawsuits of various types, and I thought if I were the school system, I would really be focusing on the federal government and their lack of, taking care of our timber, for our schools, and now we don't have any money. And so I'm just wondering, I don't see that this addresses, the liability of our state for not doing what is right and prudent and doing it now. I mean, don't we have great liability for not taking care of our natural resources that, which sums of money are to be used in for certain services?
Representative Nelson, as a representative of the Judicial Department, for better or for worse, I'm relieved of giving you legal advice. I can't tell you whether the state is subject to exposure or not. And at least as the concern of the Judicial Department in this bill is quite limited, it assumes that the legislature will pass the bill, and our concern is that the judicial review portions of it work right. And unfortunately, for better or for worse, I don't see this bill as addressing that issue. Perhaps it should, but that's a policy issue for you as a representative and the body as a whole, and that the Judicial Department does not really have a role in making recommendations on those kinds of issues.
Representative Beyer?
I'm kind of curious about this bill, and being your bill, maybe I can even address questions to you.
Actually, Representative, this is not my bill.
Okay.
This is Knope's bill, the majority leader's bill.
Okay.
I know, we're often confused. He's got red hair, I've got dark. But thank you for the promotion, Representative. I am deeply honored and touched.
Right. Well, I might just tell Representative Beyer that in the last committee, you put your name up so we knew who you were, real big up by the table.
I guess I need to do that again. I'll put a sign that says, I am not the majority leader.
Right. Cool.
And it would be nice if he was here, and maybe I should be asking him these questions. I'm not sure where we're trying to go with this bill, I guess. I mean, it sounds like we're already doing a lot of these things. Nobody's exactly testified in favor of the bill. Is there someone that's going to be?
Well, there actually is a representative of Majority Leader Knope's office here.
Okay.
And if he should choose to speak, it is entirely up to him to choose to do so. Otherwise, it is not my intention to move this bill today, but to rather have some further discussions. I think the department, both departments have brought up some valid points that should perhaps be addressed.
Well, because I would appreciate that. I'd love to have someone come talk to me about why we need it. So.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't you address Representative Beyer's concerns, Andy, after the meeting? It'd be fine. Okay. Any additional questions? Thank you both very much. I appreciate it. We're going to close. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3152? Hearing none, we're going to close public hearing on House Bill 3152. Thank you all. And we're going to open public hearings in the plural of two bills simultaneously, House Bills 3269 and House Bill 3270. They're even in sequential order. Members, these are two
bills that I drafted, a concept that I've been trying to get my arms around for some time. Rural Oregon is in a very serious decline. Rural Oregon typically is dependent upon natural resources, and one of those natural resources is our livestock industry of all types. And it became very clear to me, in fact I found it ironic, that we grow some of the finest meats in the world of different types here in Oregon, and we in essence have no processing facilities whereby that meat can be processed locally, creating jobs locally, creating economic activity locally, and it's just darn hard to find some of that meat around the state. If you go into your average grocery store, it's difficult to find some of that. I know, because I look and would like to eat some of the lamb and beef. My wife especially is, I know Margaret Magruder's here and she'll be testifying after a while. My wife is a big lamb lover and just has a hard time finding it. In fact, most of the time she's finding New Zealand lamb and that just really upsets her. And it kind of does me too. So it
could be elk, you know.
Yeah, well, it could be, yeah. Someday.
That's where we're getting the elk.
So what I thought we would do is bring forward a couple of concepts to start the discussion about how this could be one of the components of trying to create some economic activity in rural Oregon that does not currently exist. And so I brought forward these two bills. They are different. 3269 declares some legislative findings. Talking about the circumstances that we have with quote-unquote slaughterhouses, but then talking about how that it is important that we modernize what facilities we have and that we try to establish new facilities. And this bill, in essence, takes $10 million from basically the lottery dollars, OECDD funds, and for grants for the purposes of modernizing facilities with equipment and establishing new slaughterhouses. That's the concept there in terms of a grant type of an idea. 3270 is different and is much more broad-based. This says that each year 5% of the department's money will be allotted or shall be made available for loans for the establishment or projects related to slaughterhouses. It also says very clearly that there is a time limit on this of 6 years. It also says very clearly that if in a given year the dollars are not available, in other words, no one makes application or makes enough applications to utilize the entire amount of money, that the department is able to loan that money out to other business interests of other types. So we're not tying their hands in that regard. It also has a property tax exemption for 10 years. Which, of course, doesn't affect us here in terms. In fact, none of this affects us in terms of general fund, at least so far as we know. This obviously would have an impact on local property tax revenues. That is sunsetted at 10 years. There is an amendment that I have coming that is not here as of yet. On this particular bill, I am proposing that we would amend the bill that anyone who applies for exemptions or loans under this bill must make available, and this is my socially responsible part of this bill, they must make available 1% of the total meat processed on a monthly basis to the Oregon Food Bank. It seems to me a idea that if the taxpayers are going to front the money for economic development in this regard, that we go ahead and require that there be some give back, I guess, to the state. Now, there's another piece of this that probably makes a little more sense. and that is that a tax credit is available under this bill to a producer, a cattleman, a rancher, a dairyman, who decides to donate an animal to the processor for this purpose. So in essence, what would occur is that the meat would be donated to the processor. The individual who donated the animal or the meat to the processor would get tax credit. The processor, in essence, isn't out anything other than the time and the effort to process the meat and make it available. That is a proposed amendment that I have. I am probably also going to have an additional amendment. In fact, I have had an additional amendment that's currently being drafted that would put a limit on how much could go to any one project here. The concept here is that we want to encourage several of these types of facilities, not just one at a time in the state. So we wouldn't want one large project to use up all the money in a given year. We would like to limit that, but still allow it, obviously, to be an incentive to help make this situation come together. So these are the two bills, members, and the reasons why I have brought them forward so that you understand what my concept here is. And I am clearly willing to listen to the pros and cons and listen to good ideas as to how we can make this concept better, because I really would like to move this forward. I think it's time we did something that has a very positive impact for our natural resource livestock industries in the rural areas. And since we do have dollars available through the Economic Development Department for rural development, I think it's entirely appropriate that we look to them for some help in this regard. So with that, I'm going to shut up, and we're going to start calling witnesses to, I guess, share their thoughts with us on this. But before I do that, I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee members. Right. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. Why $10 million?
Frankly, it was a figure that I pulled out of the air. Okay? For the purposes of discussion, so that we can, that may not be enough, it may be too much, and that's why we'll discuss the bill.
Will we hear testimony?
Absolutely. I'm sure I see some folks from the department back there. We see folks from the industry here. I'm sure that we'll have an opportunity to discover that. Representative Nelson?
Well, I was just going to ask the Patty Smith question.
Okay. And by the way, members, I'm not necessarily saying that we need to move both of these bills as they are. It may be the wisdom of the committee that we should consider morphing them into one. We should consider possibly making grants available or not, or loans available, or both. What I'm sharing with you is that I would like your good ideas on this and would be happy to entertain your thoughts in that regard. Yes, Representative Smith.
Another question.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair Krupp. Could we not do this anyway without this bill? Why couldn't the Economic Development be giving grants if people were making applications if there was such a need?
That's a very good question, and we'll ask that question of them in a little bit. That really is a very good question. The property tax portion would require a statutory change to make that happen. President Beyer, you look like you want to ask a question.
Well, I actually, the Patty Smith question was my question. It's not something that they're eligible for now.
Just reading our mind.
It seems to me that Representative Smith is ahead of everyone on this. Okay, let's call Glenn Stonebrink and Coy Cowart from the Cattlemen's here. Anyone else you'd like to have?
Mr. Chris Bartel from F. Farpack. Formerly Bartel, he's me.
Very good.
He's my expert.
Now, you've been a cattleman for some time, Coy, and I would imagine you would have some expert testimony on this also. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming today.
Good morning, or good afternoon, wherever it is. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I just want to make a short statement and then turn it over to the professionals. I can remember when the lottery was voted in the first time in Oregon, and even though I voted against it, I remembered it was specifically for economic development. For some reason, it's gone everywhere else since that time. Cattle and calves, the sale of cattle and calves in Oregon is the highest or the largest food commodity in Oregon. Now, nurseries are, as far as commodities, have more sales, but it's kind of hard to eat those bushes. And before you think that this is like an Eastern Oregon cattle thing, it's not. In fact, Clackamas County is the number one county as far as cattle producers. So there's a lot of cattle raised on both sides of the state and a lot of cattle producers on both sides of the state. Presently, the vast majority of Oregon cattle and calves are shipped out of state for fattening and slaughter. The added value to the Oregon-grown product obviously doesn't stay in Oregon. The added value goes to other states. Jobs related to the feeding, slaughtering, and processing also goes to those other states, not Oregon. Oregon, with two major ports, have a tremendous opportunity to market in the Pacific Rim with additional slaughtering facilities. And now I'd like to yield the rest of my time, as if I had any yielded to me to begin with, to Coy Cowart, who owns the Lebanon Auction Yard, but he's also the president-elect, the president-to-be of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Welcome, Coy, and members. I should let you know that Coy is a longtime friend and is a constituent of mine, and it's good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Chairman Krupp and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I want to thank you for allowing us to testify, first of all. I know that you guys are very, very busy people, and I followed Representative Krupp around a little bit, so I know how many hours you work. So I'm going to try to keep mine quite brief and just give you a little background on the industry, if I may. I have in front of you a written testimony, but I'll probably deviate from that a little bit if you don't mind. A little background on the beef industry. The beef industry is a changing industry constantly. I don't think there's any other industry that I know of that changes more rapidly or as often. In 1960, in the state of Oregon, we had at that time 57 state license approved slaughter facilities. Now, what that meant was at that time that all of these little operations could buy and sell cattle wherever they saw fit, through the auction yards, through the farmers next door, wherever they could find them, and slaughter the animals and sell them locally to their local Safeway stores or wherever they could sell them. Just about that time, USDA come along and said, well, we think that you should be USDA inspected. And we're not sure that the state inspection system is doing what it should. So they moved in, and in a short period of time, they gave the existing slaughterhouses the option of either becoming USDA inspected, or they could go exempt and become what they call custom kill. And what that meant was that they could only kill for a backyard farmer, and none of the meat was for sale. So the majority of them chose to do that. There was still quite a few, I would say about half of them, that were became USDA inspected, certainly up to 25, I believe it was. Then in 1970, the industry changed somewhat more. There was a gentleman working for Iowa Beef Packers, which at that time and was not too large of an operation, but right now is the largest in the world and dictates to everybody. He came up with a concept called box beef. That was 70-75 long in there. What box beef meant was that you could kill an animal and cut it up and take all of the round steak, for instance, and put it in a box, where you could take all of the roast and put it in another box, and it was all segregated and then went to all the stores in that form. So that was probably the best thing that ever happened to the retailer, and it was also the best thing that happened to the packer at that time, because it gave them ability then, it gave the retailer the ability to buy just round steaks, if that's what he wanted to sell on the weekend, and he didn't have to worry about the rest of the carcass. He also could get rid of all of the guys that used to do the cutting of the carcass. So that was pretty interesting to him, and they dived in on that. One of the negative things of that was it took the ambassador for beef out of the store. So if a lady came in and said, I want a steak for 20 guests this weekend, how big should I have and what should I do to cook it and this, that, and the other, there's nobody now there to tell them. So they don't know anything about the product they're selling, the majority of them. The box beef concept actually helped get rid of the little slaughterhouses again, because it was now devoted strictly to efficiency of killing the animal, cooling it overnight, cutting it up, putting it in a box, and away it went. At the present time in Pasco, Washington, there is a plant that kills 2,500 a day. And, I mean, they go fast. And there's nobody in the world that's more efficient than those people at simply that, just cutting it up, putting it in a box, and getting rid of it. These little kill plants can't compete with that. Up in the 80s, we had another change in the industry. Consumption started declining because of a lot of reasons. All of a sudden, we shouldn't be eating meat. We were being told by the dietitians, the governor, the government, and all those folks, this is bad for you. You're going to die if you eat this, and on and on and on. So that had the effect of a pretty rapid decline in sales of beef. Then in the 90s, we hit another snag. We started into the environmental regulations and global competition. And those both look pretty negative to us, and they still look a little that way. But global competition, I believe now, has given the small packing houses the ability to do a couple of things they couldn't do before, and that was add value to their product. And through niche marketing. Now, those niche markets I have identified all over the world as being pretty huge. One of the examples of a niche market, for instance, if I was in Korea and I visited with restaurant owners, had 25 restaurants, and they wanted to buy beef from Oregon. They wanted to buy it from Oregon, and they wanted the Oregon producer to do certain things for them, a different method of cutting ribs and various other things. When they go to the large packer, IBP, ConAgra, XL, well, we don't do that. This is what we do. And so they don't have to listen to the customer. Now, that gave, I think, Oregon a real opening as far as the small slaughterhouses are concerned, because the gentleman to my right has now become quite a success story with that. So, giving you a little more background, right at the present time, I've just got these figures from Oregon Department of Ag. There's 12 small stationary slaughterhouses that are USDA licensed in the state of Oregon. True, they don't do too much business right now. Chris is USDA inspected, and he's probably, in the beef industry, is probably the biggest there is in the state of Oregon now. Now, two of those 12 small USDA-inspected plants are pork producers, and I don't represent the pork people. I'm coming out of that. So I know they need some help, and I have been helping them a little bit, but they're out. 10 of those USDA small stationary inspection plants also have retail counters, so they sell a small amount of retail over the counter, and they have the ability to do that. Then there's 16 small stationary custom-only slaughterhouses. And those are stationary. And what they do is if a farmer wants his beef killed for the winter, You can either deliver your beef to them and they'll kill it on the spot, but that beef cannot be sold. It must go back to the farmer, or he must give it to his kids or something. There is 67 custom mobile slaughter units in the state of Oregon, and those are usually trucks that can come out, and they're usually stainless steel on the inside. They can kill the farmer's cow or pig or whatever it is that he wants killed. Take the hide, the hair, and all the stuff off of it, and then deliver it either to him, and he can cut it up himself right there at his own table or whatever he wants to do, or they can deliver it to custom facilities that could cut it up for him. That meat, of course, cannot be sold, so it really isn't, you couldn't buy it. You don't have the opportunity of tasting that meat. And honest to God, that's probably the best meat in the world. But he's already raised that for himself, and under these killing conditions, you cannot buy it. The only way you can buy it is if you buy it alive, then you can do it. There is 95 custom processors that are licensed in the state of Oregon, and those people are usually like the retail stores at Safeway, and they cut them up. So what's happened to us now, I believe, is the global market has given us the ability to compete with these niche markets all over the world, including Oregon and California, Washington, what have you. And it can add some value to the product. We can't compete with the big boys. If we can add some value by cutting it the way you want it or doing the things that you want, then this man can stay in business and become productive, successful, and give us a number of jobs. I had a couple of things listed here, and Jeff's already covered those. Representative Cupton already covered those because I thought there should be some sort of a cap on this money that we're talking about as well. Now, I'd like to tell you three or four success stories in the state of Oregon, and I want to tell you it took a lot of years to get these. One of them is the gentleman to my right, and it's called S-Bar Pack. One of the others that's been highly successful, if you know anything about meat, you must have heard about this, it's called Oregon Country Beef. That's an organization that is co-op, and believe me, they are adding some value to the product. At the present time, their products are being killed out of the state of Oregon, up in Washington, and they're killing 350 to 400 head a week. But if you looked in Whole Food stores at some of their tenderloins, those tenderloins are going for over $30 a pound. If that's not adding value, I don't know how you do it. Another success story, of course, is Painted Hills. That's another small co-op that started, and I believe they're in the neighborhood of about 250 a week that they're selling. But all of this has taken place just since the global marketplace has developed. So I see an opportunity for us to help rejuvenate the beef industry or the meat industry in the state of Oregon. We also passed out a number of copies of articles that were written in different newspapers around over the country, and I'm sorry, I apologize. The reason each one of you got something a little different is because I just got them in my hand as we came in here. So they basically all say the same thing, and one of the things I liked about this, and if you bear with me, I'll read you just a little bit. Statements being made here, and it says, in hopes that our new governor will recognize the potential for economic growth in our industry, said Dalton Strauss, a cattle rancher in Central Point, Oregon, and president of the Oregon Beef Council. He wants Governor-elect Ted Kudelgowski to work with the legislator and remove barriers that have discouraged investments in processing plants. So that's in one of the articles that you guys got, and you also will find out that this has been done by the ODA. And I didn't even know this myself, but we eat 29 pounds of ground hamburger a year, and that's more than anybody else in the United States except for a small little area up around the Great Lakes area. So we eat quite a bit more hamburger than anybody. And I believe that the ODA may talk about this a little later, so I won't go into that any further. So with that, if you have any questions, if you'd like to answer them. Otherwise, I'll pass to Chris.
Yes, Representative Beyer.
When you were reading through this about removing the barriers that have discouraged investments, do you have any specific barriers that you're referring to or they're referring to?
This was made by Dalton Hobbs, but the agricultural sector in the state of Oregon and in the United States has had some real problems with environmental barriers. And I've testified a number of places, Representative Byers, excuse me, Representative Krupp, for not doing proper here. I've testified in the World Trade hearing, and some of those things that fall in place are we've asked for a level playing field. For instance, other countries that we're dealing with now that brings a product into the United States does not have to adhere to the environmental laws that we do. We have the strongest laws in the world, especially in the state of Oregon. That's very expensive for our producers, not only cattle producers, but ag producers. I'm sure that's one that they're talking about. And there's some perceptions going around out there that are absolutely not true. The friendliest thing in the world to me is a cow. And, in fact, my last name is C-O-W-A-R-T, and that's an occupational name, which means the tenders of the herd, and we've been doing it forever. But we have been blamed for polluting the rivers, killing the fish, on. You understand what I'm saying? So there's a number of things, and the perception among the majority of the voters in Multnomah County and Lane County is my food comes from Safeway in a box. I don't care about you. Those are some of the things.
Chair Krupp and Representative Beyer, if I could just camp on that for just a second. Corey talked about the environmental laws, but our beef producers also compete with other nations in the labor standards, the labor living conditions, the minimum wage, EPA and FDA standards are nothing like what we compete with. And if you look around Oregon, you see, it's a sad thing, but you see ranchers with for sale signs. And there's fewer and fewer ranchers that can't make it. The margin is so small that every little barrier that's placed there means that pretty soon one of them is going to go broke and they're going out of business. Now, what we're talking about is a way for our ranchers, because the more processing facilities you have, that's more people to compete for those cattle. And more competition means the price goes up. And it doesn't have to go up a lot to keep our people in business. So rather than the profits going to other states, we want to keep those profits in this state to our ranchers as well as jobs in the rest of the economy. So it's a close balance of whether our people stay in business or not, and we definitely would like to see helping them in some way possible.
In talking about, and I'll address this to Chris before you start your testimony, is the biggest impediment to the success of a small business like yours, a small processing facility, is the cost of complying with the USDA inspection requirements and the mandates they have?
The biggest impediment, for example, if we had an existing facility that has been there for over 40 years, to begin a new facility, the hoops that you'd have to jump through for the DEQ or all of the government regulatory agencies would be probably more of an impediment. As far as the USDA is concerned, there are a number of factors involved in expense and impediments of that nature, but the biggest impediment is that the big packer has the markets all tied up, and like Coy mentioned, the niche markets, that's where the opportunity is available at this time. That's been the biggest impediment. That's what knocked all these smaller packers out, was when they went to box beef and the big packers just tied up supply. They tied up the big grocery chains with contracts and those types of things. That's what's difficult about breaking into any market.
Why don't you scoot that microphone over in front of Chris, and Chris, start your testimony by stating your name, please.
Chris Bartels. I'm operator and general manager of what we do business now as Bartels Packing. We originally started as S-Bar Packing. My family's been in the business, in the meat packing business, since 1898 in the state of Oregon, so we have a quite a long history. We currently employ around 25 employees in our operation west of Eugene. We slaughter on an average about 60 head daily, 5 days a week, 300 head during that 5 day week. We are federally inspected. Actually, we were the first federally inspected plant in the state of Oregon, and we switched to federal inspection in 1967. We have slaughter facilities with a capacity of around 225 head daily, and fabrication with a capacity around 50 head daily. And to explain that, this plant was built in 1964, before the days of box beef, and a lot of the carcasses were shipped to the stores in quarters, carcass form. And we have a limited space, limited capacity in that manner. My parents operated the business from 64 to 95. They leased it out between 95 and 2000. We remodeled and reopened in 2000. Mostly looking at niche markets, like Coy mentioned, a lot of it is in the Asian area. We sell about 50% of our production to Korea and Japan. We just sent our first shipment to Hong Kong. That was done about 3 weeks ago. Tomorrow evening, I've got a fresh chilled shipment going by air to Tokyo. It's a half a plane load of fresh chilled beef, Oregon beef. The other half is Nike Air Soles on the plane. You mentioned Representative Krupp, brand name products for the state of Oregon. We're in the process of introducing a brand name product. It's done in conjunction with a brewery out of Portland that's been a widely known brewery here in the state of Oregon, microbrew. And the niche is going to be that the cattle are going to be fed that brewer's grain after it's used in the brewing process. We're going to feed the cattle. Hopefully, if everything works out, the majority of the cattle will be fed in Hermiston, brought down to the plant and slaughtered.
Chris, will that be beef that tastes like beer? Because
we hope so.
I'd really like to get a hold of that.
Okay. Well, that's a good sign. I hope it is. We obviously need help in modernization of the processing end of our operation. We're taking advantage right now of some market situations, like Coy mentioned, with the Asians and some of their regulatory problems that they have. Now they're allowed to come over and access the meat directly. Before, they had to go through the government or through two companies in Korea and Japan had this sort of the same restrictive situations. We sell to five different firms in Korea and two in Japan. A lot of those customers were brought to us from the Oregon Economic Group, Dalton Hobbs and John Cradival. We are benefiting also because Simplot has a slaughter plant in western Idaho, and they're decreasing operations. They were slaughtering about 600 a day in Fabingham. They're decreasing their operations to 150 a day. They can't compete against the big packers again. The big packers have centered their marketing to essentially defeat these smaller packers. Fortunately, I guess we're probably small enough that we don't make a mark on their map at this point. But anyway, we're having a number of customers approach us to fabricate some of the products that Simplot was doing prior to that. And in the same breath with Simplot, a lot of those cattle that they slaughtered were Holstein steers. And a lot of these are calves out of the dairies here locally, bull calves that are made into steers. a lot of the feedlot operators in western Idaho and eastern Washington have come to us and asked us about marketing some of the Holstein steers. And this plane load of, or half a plane load of meat that's going Friday night is Holstein beef. So we're putting a little dent in that. And just to add one little note that I noticed while you were discussing this previous bill, they talked about irradiation of ground beef, and they talked about an Iowa plant having the capability to irradiate ground beef. There's only one plant on the West Coast that can irradiate ground beef, and that's the only way the school lunch program will accept ground beef, is if it's pasteurized or irradiated. And that's a plant in Fresno, California. And it gives them a great non-competitive advantage. And just to use that as an example of what we're talking about here is being able to compete in the marketplace and having the right facility for that purpose. That pretty well covers what I had to say.
Questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking over all these studies, and from what your testimony kind of justifies or corroborates what these studies all say about, you know, that there's quite a demand, unmet demand, for Oregon beef. And I was reading the article that you mentioned regarding the urging of Governor Kulongowski to work with the legislature and remove barriers that have discouraged investments in processing plants. And so I mean, the bills that are before us are incentives, whereas it seems like from these articles, the biggest impediment are the barriers, and that's what would jumpstart or really help your industry is not so much incentives but removal of barriers. So, which both help, but it seems like that the barriers are more readily identifiable to all you. And speaking to Governor Kulongowski, these, I'm assuming, are under state jurisdiction to change these barriers that you're referring to. So I guess I just want your feedback on that. And if there is an unmet demand, and if it seems like the niche markets, and I'm one of those people who, I'm a strict vegetarian, but I feed my kids Painted Hills, and, you know, we don't make a lot of money here. So, I mean, my whole paycheck almost goes to the Painted Hills stuff. And it's not because it's organic necessarily, it's just because I know it's from Oregon, and it's not, you know, delivered in a truck for 3 days across Idaho. And So I mean, I'm one of those people who would buy Oregon beef in a heartbeat for my kids, regardless of whether or not it was organic. Just I know it was Oregon, like Foster Farm stuff. So I'm wondering if there is that huge unmet demand, you know, then why aren't the market forces compelling you guys to get out there and do it without these incentives? And I'm assuming it's the barriers. So maybe if you can help us more on that.
If I may, Representative Gilman and Representative Worth, you're absolutely right. The barriers are a big problem, but we've been trying to remove those for a lot of years, and we haven't been very successful. So we want to try a different approach. And the demand for Oregon beef is so monstrous, there's no way you can even dream how big it really is. I think Oregon is 28th in production of beef right now as far as the states are concerned, and that is really relatively insignificant. My hopes, of course, is that we can increase the industry in the state of Oregon to about 15th. I would like to, in the next 25 years, I would like to increase demand and the beef production in the state of Oregon by 25%. And how I do that, of course, is repair my infrastructure that's been demolished over the years. You have a difficult time now outside of Oregon Trail. You have a difficult time identifying another piece of meat that came out of the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. So because the majority of it would be killed in Washington. However, a lot of it is killed in Nebraska, Kansas, Texas. And so we cannot identify an Oregon product. Now, through a lot of surveys done with National Cattlemen Beef Association quite some time back, when we had a 28-year decline in beef consumption, we found out, and we should have all known this in the first place, it was so evident we missed it, but we found out that you trust your neighbor before you trust somebody else. The same is true with the beef product or a food product. So we're moving, the entire industry all over the United States is moving more to a customer demand base. You go to the customer, what do you want? And whatever they want, we want to provide it for them. And that is the reason that these little most of these little kale plants left in Oregon, you should visit one of those things. It's looked pretty bad. Mm-hmm. It really does. You know, the buildings are falling down. They're not driving new pickups. They're just barely making it. And one of the reasons why they're still there is because they're hard-headed like me and they're dedicated. And those are actually the two reasons they're there, not because of profit. So everybody would like to eat Oregon beef. We have a tremendous name. Oregon has one of the most wonderful names in Japan, and in Korea, and even in Russia. I mean, they know about our product all over, and I don't know how they did that unless it was that movie we made a lot of years ago in the state of Oregon, From Oregon with Love, and I believe that was into Japan. But when you, and I'm from grassroots, so I don't go over and have dinner with the ambassador. I go over and lay down on the floor with the peasants, and I roll around on the floor and blow their children on the belly button, the little guys, and that's me. So actually, I get to the heart of what the problem is pretty easily. Even in the United States, the general public knows what the problem is before we do a $10 million survey. So that's where I go in the first place, to talk with these folks. And what they tell me, they tell me I'm just like the Krupp family in Oregon. Just like them. And honest to God, they are. There's good folks over there, and there's bad ones. And when you go at them and with that approach, you find out some really interesting things, and they tell you, why don't you put my family, the Lee family, together with the Bartell family, and let us do business? And that's what we'd hope to do with these two bills that Representative Krupp is proposing. If there's a better way, we certainly want to hear it from you guys, because I'm depending on you guys. You are experts at this, really, and you know how to do this. And Representative Krupp has been so gracious just to introduce the bills. Nobody had done that for us for 40 years in the state of Oregon. So I have to thank all of you for just listening to us, because we can't even get past that barrier with everybody else. So thank you very much.
Representative Beyer, you have a question.
Yes. Chris, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, it's very refreshing to hear your success story. I mean, it's been kind of a rough week down in the Eugene area and south, so it's really good to hear a success.
Thank you.
Where are you? Are you about at your capacity? Are you thinking of expanding or?
We as I mentioned before, we have a limited fabrication, and fabrication means taking the carcass and boning it and removing the bone and cryovacking and subprimals, top sirloins, New York strips, tenderloins, so on and so forth. That's where we need our expansion. That's where we need our area. The contract, and I mentioned the air freight shipment we've got going out, is carcass beef, because we're not able to fabricate One of the prerequisites to this contract was the understanding that our Asian customer knew that we weren't going to be able to fabricate as much as he wanted fabricated, and he was willing to take a certain amount of carcass. We weren't able to carry that contract that much further and contract some of the fabricated cuts, because we just don't have the capacity to do that. One interesting point, and Coy mentioned that Country Natural Beef is an Oregon product. They have their cattle slaughtered and processed in Yakima, Washington. because there is no facility here in the state of Oregon. And you know, that's where we need to expand. We'd probably, with our expansion, as I said, we're employing 25 people. It would probably double our employment there west of Eugene to around 50 people. And we've just barely tapped this Asian market. There's a number of companies that have been buying a lot of their meat from Australia in Asia because it's obviously closer, that would like to buy U.S. beef because it's better, because we have better grains, we have better cattle, and they're interested in buying from Oregon because it's the closest area. They don't want to buy, this company that we just contracted with doesn't want to purchase from Chicago because the meat has to be trucked, just like Representative Worth said, that, you know, she doesn't want to buy something that's trucked halfway across the country. Well, the Asians feel the same way.
Representative Krupp, if I may, one other little tiny thing. One reason why this would work, ladies and gentlemen, is we have an example we can take a look at in Woodland, Washington. It's another small kill plant, and it's owned by a gentleman by the name of Walt Hauser. It's called Walt's Meats, and it's 20 miles the other side of the border in Washington. And I've dealt with him extensively, the same as I have with Chris. And the reason I could do that is because he comes to my auction yard and purchases cattle and then takes them up there, and that's Oregon cattle that's being processed in Washington. Now, Walt's been in business as the Bartelt family for about 40 years, and nobody could put him out of business. What he kills now is what we refer to as slaughter cows, and that's where the majority of your hamburger comes from. And those are most usually about half of them are Holsteins or dairy cows that come out of our dairies. And they come for hamburger for a lot of reasons. One is just because the barn's full. And so you take the least productive cow and you sell her. So Walt kills about 126 of those today, and he comes to Oregon and buys these. What happened usually to a kill plant, if you get very large, then IBP, ConAgra, or Excel, the big boys that have control of the market, they're going to put their foot on your head and you're going to be broke in a short while. There is slaughter facilities all over the state of Oregon. There's two or three in Oklahoma. They're just everywhere that are really quite modern facilities that maybe only stayed in business for like 5 years. And that is because they were becoming competitive with IBP. Now, the reason that we think the small ones will work is because Walt just built a brand new fabrication system about a year and a half ago. It's not very large. Didn't cost a lot of money. He now is breaking ground ceremony for his new kill facilities, and he's increased his business by $5 million a year just by putting in the two little facilities. And then IBP approached him, and rather than put their foot on his head, they said, "Well, look, Walt, you're not to capacity killing. Would you be interested in fabricating two semi-loads of choice carcasses per day for IBP?" Well, definitely he would, and so with all these other smaller ones. So here's a case of the big packer enhancing a smaller slaughterhouse rather than, if you get too large, he'll put you out of business. He's not afraid of the small slaughterhouses because we're in the niche market, and he may even welcome us. We certainly hope so.
Representative Gilman.
I have back to the... Or maybe the hamburger. I have a question. What would it cost to set up a plant to process hamburger?
I've been told that the machine to irradiate ground beef is around $1 million.
That's what it's free.
Chris, in looking at your operation, you want to double the size of your operation in essence. Mm-hmm. What's that going to cost you?
We already have lots. We have 8 acres there on our site that's zoned for that purpose.
So you're on Airport Road, aren't you?
No, actually, we're that used to be one of our plants.
Oh.
We're over west of Eugene, out toward Fern Ridge Lake, toward
okay.
Bonita.
11th.
Yeah.
The end of 11th.
All right.
Yeah.
We're out. So we have 8 acres there available. So we've got lots of room available as far as the ground is concerned. It would just be a physical building, and I've got estimates coming in, but just off the top of my head, it would be around $300,000 to $400,000 to make the improvements enough to fabricate that around about 150 head versus 50 head on a daily basis. And I told you that I'd double the our staff. It would probably actually add quite a few more jobs than just doubling. It may very well triple, because fabrication requires more labor than slaughter does. Mm. Slaughter's a more efficient operation.
I see. Members, I'd like to go till 3:30 if you can. If you can't, I understand. That's perfectly all right. We're not going to move these bills today, but there are four other people that would like to share their thoughts with us, and I'd really like to hear what they have to say on this. And I've got a couple more questions for Chris.
Okay.
In looking at these bills, how would these bills help you? Would they help you? Would they help anyone who wanted to upgrade their facility? I mean, you just talked about irradiated hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a lot of money for a machine to do that.
Right.
But if someone were to make that investment, do you think the return on investment would be there in the business today? How would these bills impact you?
To use that as an example, I know for a fact that they have, it's BPI, Beef Packers Incorporated in Fresno, California, that has the only machine, I think it's west of the Mississippi.
Mm.
And you can imagine the kind of advantage they have there. I've been told, and I don't know, I've been told that gives them a $50,000 advantage daily on their ground beef.
My goodness.
That they benefit $50,000 a day because of that machine. Because the federal government requires that ground is irradiated for the, and it's for the military as well. So there's two areas there. And just being able to go out and competitively approach Country Natural Beef, approach Oregon Trail Beef. Oregon Trail Beef had to go outside the state to look for someone that could slaughter and fabricate. A big part of that is the fabrication area of the plant. And that's where we need the help. We would greatly benefit, the state would greatly benefit from added jobs, and you know, these people over a year's time gain a journeymanship of being what they call a meat cutter. And the wages are up in the $12 to $13 area.
I see.
We're not presented with very many trained people because the plants are so far away. We haven't hired a trained person since we started down there. We've trained all of our staff from the beginning, because we just don't have anybody apply that has that expertise. The one area that would be non-competitive in the bill is the 1% donation, and that I could you clarify that intention in that area, so I fully understand that, Representative Kraft?
You can beat up on Coy for that, because that was his idea to me, okay?
Okay.
The concept there was that, and I'm not married to the 1% figure necessarily, but the concept was that for taking advantage of the provisions in the bill in terms of the loan or potentially grants and the property tax elimination for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
that you would make a small portion of the beef you process available.
Mm-hmm.
The concept there is that that doesn't cost you the beef cost out of pocket, because there's a tax credit available
mm-hmm.
for one of the dairymen or your maybe Coy, whatever, takes one of his cattle and he donates it to you for the Oregon Food Bank. He gets the tax credit. You don't pay anything for the meat to be processed, except your labor cost of actually processing the meat and sending it on to the food bank. How would that impact you? I mean, what, you're doing what, 60 head a day?
Mm-hmm. It's about $75,000 a day. So 1% of that would be $750 a day. And if we're talking about increasing our production, it would be anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000 a day. So that would you know, put a dent in it.
Sure. Okay. Okay. Is there is that a concept you think would be viable for someone like you as a packer, instead of, you know, I think I have that amendment written as 1% a month. Is there a lower number that works for you as a packer?
I like the idea, and I think there's some advantages to some of the items that we produce that could be given to food banks and things of that nature. Some of the items that aren't highly marketable that have great food quality. Livers pop into my mind, and I know everybody doesn't want to eat liver all day long and every day, but there's some of the products that could be done, and as you mentioned, the tax advantage to a farmer would be something. And we have a unique situation where we do actually bring in beef, and we still slaughter and custom cut and wrap. If you were raising two-headed steers, you can still bring them to our plant. We're small enough that we still do those types of things.
I see.
And so we would have the availability or the ability to do something along the lines of doing a donation for that purpose. And I see that would be better suited I try to place a number on it would be difficult at this time. But
what does it cost you to process a beef, let's say?
About $250 to custom cut and wrap, about $175 to fabricate and box.
If you were going to give it to the food bank, what would be the best way to package that, I guess?
Custom cut and wrap. Grind the hamburger, cut the roast, tie the roast, cut the steaks, do the whole thing. You know, in food banks, I don't think want prime rib. I think they want ground beef.
Yeah.
And that's another thing to take into account.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, very good. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. It's nice to see you twice. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, I am so proud of you. I just want to jump up and down. We just, need more young people just like you, and you're assuming someone very akin to you back here. But we need more and more people like you that, get up and get going. To put a turnkey operation together with the six M's, the management, money, men, machines, material, and markets, what would a turnkey, we keep talking about size, small size, niche size.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it would take to launch one?
Just from the ground up,
uh-huh.
Just to start one, I would, we put a number on it here the other day, and it was very rough, but our plant, if we were going to start it, just, you got to acquire the permits and all of the other things that are involved, and you've got to get USDA writ of inspection. We had writ of inspection with this. Our establishment number is 497, which is the second lowest in west of the Mississippi.
All right.
So we've had that establishment as far as USDA is concerned for a long time. If we were to build our facility today, it'd be around $6
million. So, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Follow-up. My concern is this $10 million figure. We should get out of here and quit talking about it because it doesn't – I mean, that's – maybe we worked really hard. We might get two facilities. But is there a follow-up, please? Coy, is there a – can we regionalize this operation? I keep wanting to do this because I'm worrying about the four corners of Oregon and –
Representative Gilman, Representative Nelson, I guess the best way that I know how to answer that kind of a question is if I could take you and let you look at a new facilities. Just take you up there. And that's real close. I believe that as soon as the Director of Ag gets a little time, I'm rigging up a trip to take her to Walt's Meats at Woodland, Washington. And Walt basically has done it from the ground up. And you have to understand that Walt is the most frugal man in the world. So I'm thinking that he did this one for about $2.5 million. But I would love to take you up there sometime, and the other members of the board, if they would like to look at it. I'm sure that the Oregon Department of Ag could furnish us with a van. It would just be a matter of getting us together and my time is open because I've just about donated myself to this industry. So if that's something that would be attractive to you guys, I certainly would love to take you there. And Walt, of course, would be delighted to see you. And once you saw the plant, then all of this negative stuff goes away that people throw at us and the smoke screens and all that and all the reasons why it can't be done. When you look at a man that is doing it, then you know.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I want to go visit Chris's operation.
Yes.
Too. And I'd just like to ask one more question, if I could, please. When we were discussing last summer our project using your auction yards and my quarantine yards to move beef to Korea, do they prefer it? How do they prefer their beef? I mean, they want these live creatures.
Representative Gilman, Representative Nelson, I'd like to defer to Chris because he is doing it. Actually, he's doing it right now.
Great.
Actually, we are working on a contract. I'm partnered with some feedlots in Eastern Oregon and Western Idaho, and the company that we're dealing with also has feedlots in Korea, and they've asked us to quarantine around 850 head on a monthly basis of black cattle,
right.
And they're like we are. They want their beef fresh. They prefer it to be slaughtered right there in country. But if they can, they prefer to get it fresh. It's expensive to fly a half a plane load of beef to Japan or Korea, either one. So they do prefer it fresh. They do prefer certain breeds, and the Angus breed is their preference. As I mentioned, I've introduced. We started selling them Holstein steers here just recently. This will be our first shipment of Holstein beef. And the dairy breeds tend to be more marbled, and that's what they're after. They're after long-fed cattle that are well marbled, and they really, really appreciate the marbling. They really appreciate the flavor of the beef.
And just one more, please, because I think it's wonderful, and I'm just going to, you know, support any economic development project that we can get. But why have we even talked to the economic development department? I mean, here they're spending $436 million biennium. They've spent $2.6 billion since they started in 1975, and our per capita income is lower in this state than it ever was. I'm just wondering, are we talking to them about this project, or have we previously? And McCoy, have they turned us down?
Well, traditionally, we haven't received a fair share. And for some reason, our projects are never worthy.
Do we get any from them for the cattle market?
I'm unaware of any money coming into the cattle market from economic development.
Development.
I don't know of any money at all. There may be some, but I sure don't know about it.
Well, actually, that's a good question and a good segue. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. And speaking of economic development, it's appropriate, I think, you come forward and we ask you that question. We got about 12 minutes, and I really would like to hear from everyone, but I think that's inappropriate that we ask you just kind of what's going on there. And for the record?
Yes. Chairman Kropp, members of the committee, my name is Ron Fox. I'm the manager of business and industry programs with the Oregon Economic Community Development Department, and I'm pleased to have an opportunity to contribute to this discussion. I think, first of all, I think the concept of the both bills, both 3269 and 3270, are right in line with our mission and goal objectives, which is to promote Oregon's industries and agriculture, and the cattle business is clearly one of those. I think our concern is with the dedication of funds to a specific industry, which and the allocation of funds from our community development account, which in the governor's recommended balanced budget, I think, is about $25 million. So this allocation of 10 would represent about 37% of that fund. So it would limit our ability to perform a broad spectrum of services in support of Oregon's businesses and industries. I do think that we have a number of programs that can support these types of agricultural industry sectors, both from our business loan finance programs as well as our industry sector assistance support. And we do have access to the governor's administrative strategic reserve fund, which is used frequently to assist projects in sort of being the closing component that makes projects feasible and viable. We'd be very interested in working with members to find ways to make those more accessible. We do have, as I said, we do have a number of business loan programs that we operate in conjunction with the commercial business banking community. So we have a broad spectrum of opportunities in there.
Great. Thank you, Ron. Representative Nelson, a quick question for Ron.
I'm just curious. Thank you for being here. And I really hope, Mr. Chair, I hope you come back and you bring your books and we can open them and see what we've been doing since 75 to help the agriculture in this state, because I've not seen it, and I've been in several, you know, markets from raising goats to pigs to you name it. But I'm concerned that we are letting another state take care of our people. I mean, where we here basically have responsibility for our school kids, but yet we're paying another state to provide the meat. We have the responsibility to take care of our inmates, but we're paying another state while we've got all this capacity here. And I'm just curious, don't you think that should be considered?
Chairman Kropp, Representative Nelson, well, I think absolutely. I think part of the mission that the department has is to improve the value-added component of Oregon's business, both agriculture as well as other sectors. I'm not familiar with the discussion on the irradiation. That was very interesting and but news to me. And I suspect, but I don't know the facts, that there are some substantial regulatory requirements associated with these irradiation devices, and that may be one of the reasons that they're not generally distributed in the business. But I'd be happy to do some looking into that and let you know what I find on that.
Okay. And with that, we're going to have to end your testimony for today anyway, Ron, but thanks for coming up and answering those questions. Chair, I'd like to call Glenn Krebs and Margaret Magruder, two well-traveled today. They have traveled over 100 miles to get here, and they have prepared testimony. And by golly, we're going to take the time to listen to what you have to say and maybe ask you some questions, too. Welcome to you both, and for the record, state your names.
Thank you. Margaret Magruder from Clatskanie, Oregon, and we're here to testify in support of the bills. And for your wife's information, Glenn and I have visited over 40 grocery stores in the Salem and Eugene area in the last couple days, and there are about 10 of them that carry
really?
Oregon lambs.
Wow. Very good.
Yes. Orville Roth, if I can mention a name.
He is he's actually a constituent of mine.
Yeah.
Well, wait, so,
okay. He's a great supporter of Oregon agriculture. Thank you, Chairman Krupp and committee, for allowing us to testify. I'm going to let Glenn give the bulk of the testimony. Glenn has an interesting history, as he has built and managed a processing facility in Hardin, Australia, a state-of-the-art facility.
Wow.
So he brings us some good information. So
very
I'll
good.
Let Glenn take our
Thank
time.
You, Margaret. Welcome, Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I was pleased in your opening remarks that you mentioned meat and species.
You need to say your name.
It's Glenn Krebs, Hermiston, Oregon.
Please continue.
I was pleased to hear you mention meat and not just strictly beef, because
right.
the poor sheep herders kind of get left to the end of the meeting at times. So
I have a lot of friends who are sheep herders down my neck of the woods, so I am sensitive to that issue.
There you go. But we believe that this is an opportunity for Oregon to take a needed step in enhancing their revenue by increasing these value-added opportunities in agricultural processing. We're currently engaged, Margaret and I, in a study to identify the obstacles to increasing the consumption of lamb and to strengthening the Oregon lamb industry. This effort is funded through the USDA Value Added Development Grant, and the objective is which is to determine the feasibility of siting a lamb processing facility in the state of Oregon. The fact that Oregon has no technologically advanced commercial slaughter facilities is the reason we're pursuing this project. With adequate documentation gleaned through this study, the long-range goal will be to pursue the funding for development of a slaughter facility. to advance the growth of the Oregon lamb industry. The lack of adequate lamb processing facility in the state is a primary barrier to the future growth within the sheep industry. Oregon is one of the top 10 sheep-producing states in the nation. There are approximately 3,000 Oregon sheep producers that annually supply the 250,000 lambs, but only 2.2% of those lambs are processed in the state. This takes a considerable amount of potential value-added revenue dollars out of our state. 70% of the American lambs are slaughtered and processed in only 5 plants within the United States. The nearest commercial processing facility for Oregon producers are in California and Colorado. Costs of transporting of these live lambs to the nearest slaughter facilities costing Oregon producers an estimated $1 million annually. It's a significant impact to the bottom line of Oregon producers that are already struggling through the past bad seasons that they've had. A processing facility in Oregon would also make it possible for lambs from Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Northern California to be processed in the state of Oregon. Processing facilities in Oregon would increase the potential to supply domestic product so as to minimize the reliance on foreign imports. There's a demonstrated need for upgraded lamb processing facilities in Oregon. The lack of adequate processing infrastructure makes it difficult for direct marketers of Oregon lamb to market an Oregon-branded product and limits their ability to expand these budding Oregon businesses. A 1997 survey done by the Oregon Sheep Growers Association revealed that Oregon consumers prefer an Oregon-grown product, and they're willing to pay a premium price for it. And we'd like to have this opportunity to fill this need. Oregon's only facilities are outdated in equipment and design and lack the modern technology to produce a competitively packaged product for the marketplace. Many retailers are no longer have the skilled meat cutters on staff, and thus they require a case-ready product. Food safety issues are extremely important points to consider. In 2002, the U.S. faced the largest number of meat recalls in our history. This points to the need for positive changes in meat processing technology. Processors spend significant amount of dollars on irradiation and chemical sanitation to provide a safe meat product. And there are new technologies available to avoid the contamination during processing that would lessen the need of these cleanup techniques. The demands of implementing the HACCP procedures are an added expense to processors. In order to meet the increased HACCP regulations required of all processors and encourage the need to technological updates to improve food safety, funding support is required. The incentives offered by these bills would attract investment in processing. This would provide an opportunity for Oregon to be a leader in developing and implementing the most sanitary and efficient processing techniques in the world, improving products for the domestic consumer and opening the doors for export of Oregon meat products. Oregon could be a showcase of new technology in this field. Our important points to consider are the current need to bring economic development to rural areas and the opportunity to multiply dollars by keeping this processing activity in the state. In-state lamb slaughter would lead to increased value-added processing, growth in distributing, and sustainable agriculture. This vertical integration will result in a more diversified revenue base and the potential to generate future revenue dollars for the state of Oregon. We encourage your support of these two bills in order to bring needed economic development to the state of Oregon and assure the viability of the Oregon sheep industry. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Glenn. Margaret, members, questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you for being here, and I'm curious about your backgrounds, but I guess I can find that out later and how you got in this business. So we used to raise sheep, too, but... Speaking of the meat market, now we got to break it up. The pork, the beef, the lamb, whatever else you want to call it. How would those be equal, do you think, out of the state of Oregon? I mean, as far as production needs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, are you talking about percentage of consumption?
Well, or market.
The best way I'd probably answer that is that lamb generally takes up about 1% of meat sales. I'm not quite sure. As far as consumption go, the latest increase has been in the poultry industry. It has bypassed beef. I'm not sure. Each state's a bit different. But as a nation, I think poultry has bypassed the beef as far as per capita consumption. The per capita consumption of lamb has happened to be going down and has had a downward trend for quite some time. And that is why that we're trying to find ways to increase this. There has been a tremendous push here in the state of Oregon by direct marketers, which are doing an excellent job, but they are having obstacles or problems in front of them, and that's what we're trying to help work through.
So final question.
One more. Thank you.
So as far as facilities right now to handle the lamb,
there's a few people that are doing it, but as Coy mentioned earlier, I think he used the word was bad, and I'd have to agree with him. There is definitely a need for improvement. Our competitors overseas are whipping the pants off of us, and we need to compete with them.
Can you mix meat? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Can you mix meat in these slaughterhouses?
There is multi-species slaughterhouses, but you have to be careful on when and how. There's a procedure that's in place on processing them. But if you've had a slaughterhouse that's designed for beef and a slaughterhouse that's designed for lamb, they are two different things. To get the good efficiencies of the beef and the efficiencies of the lamb, you need machinery and technology that's separate.
Okay, thank you. And one quick question for him before you speak. What would the cost be of, in your mind, of establishing a state-of-the-art meat processing facility of any type?
We could provide, just structurally now, because we don't know where this would be, $2 million would go a long ways in providing a lamb slaughterhouse that could handle Oregon's needs.
And that would be for lamb. What would you estimate for cattle?
Depending on the size. I think...
You said 5 million a while ago.
Oh, okay. All right.
Really said 6, but we decided we'd make it half.
Cutting down already.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask if the market is as good internationally for lamb as it is for beef?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the lamb market right now is at a high. There are several factors that's happened internationally because of the drought in Australia and New Zealand, and the lamb shortage in the U.S. has driven the lamb prices up. The demand for it is good at the moment, and we do have good lamb prices. We have to be careful on how we fill that need.
Yeah, very good. Margaret, you want to say something else?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that the plant that Glenn managed in Australia, because of the technology that they used, the shelf life of the product was 9 to 12 weeks in the cryovac packaging. And that's not after you get it out of that and put it in the meat case. And the shelf life of product that we, in my experience in direct marketing, if I could get 3 to 4 weeks out of the product that was processed in the plant in Washington that I had to use when I was direct marketing lamb, I felt quite lucky if I could get that kind of a shelf life.
Wow.
So there's a need for the technology.
That's extraordinary. You got to make it faster.
I just want to know, is your radiation of, is that only beef or is that all meat?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, that is mostly used in the ground beef sector.
So lamb,
yeah,
poultry.
And as I mentioned in Margaret, we achieved that longer shelf life by not having what's happening in the U.S. with the sanitation cabinets and irradiation. we or chemical, they chemicals, sanitation or steam. We've done this by work practice and procedures. So it can be done, and we could use Oregon as a showcase to do this. We have proved it already in Australia.
Wow, that's impressive. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. Mary Stewart, you've been patiently waiting. After her, we have Greg Addington, and bringing up the batting cleanup today is Dalton Hobbs after Greg. So welcome, Mary. Great to have you here today.
Well, thank you. And I also bring greetings to you, Chair Krupp, and members of the Agriculture Committee, at least who's left. And but I do want to acknowledge and thank Chair Krupp and also Vice Chair Gilman for attending the Driving Hunger Out of Oregon event that we held on National Agriculture Day, Friday the 21st. We had a wonderful parade of semis full of Oregon-produced foods, and on that day, we gave more than 50,000 pounds of Oregon-produced foods to the Oregon Food Bank.
Very good.
And that was just, and what a wonderful thing that agriculture steps up regularly and provides about 60% of the food that is given to the food bank each year. And I also wanted to mention, you had asked a question about the food bank and how they will accept the meat. One of the things I learned in working with them is, yes, they'd be more than happy to have retail-ready cuts, but they also have money, cash available, to pay for carcasses to be cut or primals to be cut. So be aware of that.
I see. Okay. Very good.
I'll be really brief because I know you have very little time.
And we appreciate your very nice handouts.
Just some little handouts about the importance of buying local. And
Adam, could I ask?
She did, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
I mean, we did?
There may be a little packet there for you.
Should be.
I'm Mary Stewart, as I said earlier, Executive Director of Agribusiness Council of Oregon. We are a statewide, industry-wide, private, nonprofit trade association. We work to really keep agriculture viable in Oregon. We do that through public education and through farm profitability programs. We connect the agriculture to the public, or the farm to the city is another way to think about it. We really work to have a good understanding of how to reach and resonate with Oregonians, especially those who live in population centers who may be generations removed from the farm. And I'm here today to really share some evidence of potential growth that will generate dollars and jobs for Oregon, especially in the rural areas. And from my observations, I believe that the domestic and international marketplace will support additional niche sales of meat from Oregon. I believe that the number of jobs in the ag sector will increase significantly when additional meat harvest facilities are in place or current ones are updated and enhanced. First, the marketplace. Consumers are seeking food security. They want to know where their food is produced, who produced it, and how it was produced. Localized harvest facilities processing meat raised in Oregon by Oregon ranchers and adhering to good agricultural practices and providing a way to have product identity as set forth by the Oregon Department of Agriculture has some real intangible possibilities to meet this consumer demand. And a small model of success is the Oregon Country Beef Project, where 30 ranching families have joined together to do some marketing of their product. And what they've been able to do is really sell to a niche at a very premium price. Now, they ship about 400 head of cattle a week to a Washington harvest facility. Secondarily, jobs. In Oregon, agriculture brings about $8.6 billion to the economy each year, and ag has the potential to contribute much more. One in every 12 Oregonians currently works in Oregon, and that's in the growing, producing, and first-level processing. We have about 41,000 farms in Oregon. Cattle and calves are the second largest commodity in Oregon, and nearly a quarter of which are cattle operations. We have about 9,500 cattle and calf operations. We send about 500,000 cattle to harvest each year. And in 2001, the value of cattle sales was around $423 million. Now, if we could harvest and pack those cattle in Oregon, the potential is significant for number of jobs, number of new jobs. And this was just beef that I've been talking about here. But, of course, lamb and pork is another very important sector with a lot of potential. And so I really recommend that there is serious consideration of this opportunity. And I know that one of the things that may be of concern to the public agencies is that this is just one segment of the industry. And this may set a precedent. At Agribusiness Council, we understand that. We're always struggling with that. How can we be fair to everybody when we're providing programming? But perhaps this could be seen as a pilot project, and that other segments could be addressed in the course of a long-range plan. So it's not that you're giving, you know, favor to one or the other. It's just that this has tremendous potential right now, and let's make sure and plug in the other ones as we go along. And at the same time, let's implement lessons that we've learned in this project. And I think perhaps that this type of support should be leveraged with some of the existing opportunities. And some of those opportunities have been mentioned. Some special funds through Oregon Economic Development, through the governor's funds. You know, let's see if we can't leverage that. But I'm really unsure about the wisdom of doing that completely or only. I'm not sure how successful that's going to be. And if you do that, however, I think it's important that you have an expediter assigned to the industry so that they can help the industry actually work through those, you know, that grant process, that loan process. I would highly recommend that. But I think the combination of the two might be the strongest results. I brought some fact sheets for you. If we can ever help with general information about the industry, providing identity to Oregon's products, please let us know. We do provide the Product of Oregon Landmark of Quality mark, and a lot of public education support behind that. I really thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. I hope I've been helpful, and would be more than willing to help in the future. Are there any questions?
I just want to thank you for these great fact sheets.
Certainly.
I love it, and I think that knowledge is power. And I'm just wondering, we'll have to talk about it today, but, you know, when we talk about all the commodity commissions and all these things, you know, right, when I hear issues like this, I want to know, where's everybody been? I mean, why are we doing this right now when this is, you know, I wasn't aware we had such a problem with slaughterhouses other than my one project on moving, you know, cattle to Korea.
And I think that's a very valid question. Why hasn't this been able to move forward within the public agency system?
So, anyway, thank you for all your help.
I'd
be interested in knowing if you can give me some backup information, because I think the whole legislature is going to be shocked that we've done so little here.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Appreciate your patience and time today. Greg. I don't know why I always seem to call you last at the end of a very long day of hearings, but by golly, I appreciate the fact you've stayed also, and thank you for your written testimony.
And then we remember what he says because he's last.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I learn every day in this role, and today's lesson is get to the sign-up sheet earlier, I think.
And for the record, you are.
For the record, Greg Addington with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I submit a written testimony, and I will let you refer to that. Just to point out a couple of things, it was mentioned that the livestock or cattle and calves are the number two commodity in the state. the problem is that they are sold as a commodity. Some of the other commodities in the state have a little better advantage as far as marketing. You can have a roadside stand for fruits and vegetables. You can have a mail order for your nursery stock. It's hard to sell ground beef on a roadside stand. You can't do it. So
they
think
they sell fish this way, though, Mr. Chair, don't they?
They do, actually, I think, to some extent. I see Dalton shaking his head, so yeah.
So I just point that out as, you know, we're very supportive of the concept of these bills. And I would just like to underscore what the chair said to lead off the hearing on these bills, and that is the fact that there's a lot of talk about economic development right now. And I just want to be sure that we're talking about economic development for the entire state.
That's right.
And that's a big concern of ours. So very much appreciate the chair bringing these bills forward. Let us know how we can help any process of combining the two, or we're happy to take part in and be involved. And
okay.
So with that, I will cut
Thank
it off.
Thank you, Greg. I do appreciate it. Thanks for your support. Dalton. Batting cleanup, and again, very, very patient, and the chair thanks you, and I've probably mucked up the rest of your afternoon, but such as it is.
That's fine. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Dalton Hobbs. I serve as the administrator of the Agricultural Development and Marketing Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'd like to thank Representative Krupp and members of the committee for giving us an opportunity here. As a background, perhaps a little bit late in the day, the production of agriculture ranks as Oregon's second leading ag sector. Producers across the state, as you've heard earlier, contribute about $500 million to the state's economy. But it's really livestock that derives that value and not the production of meat products. In fact, if you take a look at the existing processing capacity right now in Oregon, this infrastructure is only capable of handling at most 15% of our livestock production, that is able to convert 15% into consumer-ready products. Mm-hmm. So as we speak, there's probably 1.5 million head of cattle in Oregon. And we estimate at the outside only about 70,000 head are currently being slaughtered on an annual basis. And nearly all of our processing slaughterhouses now are operating at or near current capacity. And to put it into perspective, the annual output of the 10 principal beef slaughterhouses in Oregon, the output of those represents about 25% of Oregon's annual beef consumption, if you look at the per capita consumption. But what's interesting is that as with Mr. Bartell's plant and others, most of their production is actually shipped outside of the state for use as an export product or as a ground beef. Export markets that our department has worked very hard to develop in Korea and Japan are critical in that part. Interestingly, in fact, though, you'd be very, very hard-pressed to purchase a cut of beef in a normal supermarket throughout Oregon that was actually slaughtered at an Oregon slaughter plant. As you've heard earlier, product is shipped out of state for processing. Even our venerated Oregon country beef has to go to Washington to be fabricated. And so there's a critical need for this right now. There's no question within the beef industry there's consensus that more needs to be done. And I think that Representative Krupp, I think in your travels last fall to Japan, you recognized the need that whatever we do, though, that it be done very good quality. I think you may recall some of the labeling that is now required in Japan for beef products. When we do increase or when we do build new slaughter capacity here in Oregon, it's going to be critical to build it to these international specifications. Also, as Glenn was talking about, we need to have that high technology to allow us to have the long shelf life, low pathogen count products that allow us to compete internationally. Having given this background, let me offer the following observation specific to these two pieces of legislation. We have talked with our counterparts at the Department of Economic Development and taken a look at this legislation. We think that currently existing state loan and other business incentive programs are probably sufficient to meet the needs of existing plants that wish to expand their operations or service investors that wish to site new slaughter capacity here in Oregon. Now, I have the unenviable position of delivering this news to you, but there are a number of existing programs that offer grants, loans, job training, assistance in siting, et cetera. And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, with regard to what has been done to date, our department, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, has worked very closely with the Economic Development Department to assist Mr. Bartels in terms of financing through some of these existing programs, expansion of his facility. And when his facility is, when he comes and has is in a position where he's received his estimates for expansion and so on, I've been given assurances by the Economic Development Department that they will actively consider this as part of their program of work. So I believe that there is the ability under existing programs to finance the Oregon Business Development Fund, your Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, these kinds of facilities. What is really needed is the investors and the private sector folks to come forward and say, you know, I want to get into this business. Last session, Senator Hartung spearheaded some legislation that appropriated money to study what it would take to site a state-of-the-art beef processing plant in Oregon. That study was completed, and it did in fact show that Oregon can produce a world-class product in a competitive way at a facility in Oregon. Financing for that plant is currently being arranged, and I would expect that within 6 to 12 months that you will see a groundbreaking of a state-of-the-art processing plant in that regard.
Where?
This would be in Central Oregon in Madras. And this is something that our department, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, has worked very, very hard on in terms of encouraging and enhancing this new infrastructure and so on. In terms of expense, $5 to $6 million is probably adequate in terms of some facilities. However, as envisioned and as explored by this study that was done, this facility in Madras would be close to $24 million in terms of its cost.
And what are they going to do, Mr. Chair? Excuse me.
They're going to process about 100,000 head a year, I think, out of that facility.
That's correct. And most of this product will be process to an export specification for customers in Japan and Korea, with probably a quarter of it going into the Oregon market, which will have the microbiological plate counts to meet the specification for the school lunch program, which will give that facility the ability
so
to
we can take over them.
That's right. And
find the beef in California.
As Glenn was saying, part of this is practices, and in order to have these good practices that lower the plate counts, the microbiological plate counts, you need to have a purpose-built facility. Many of the facilities, unfortunately, in Oregon were built 40, 50, 100 years ago, and it's very, very difficult and costly to retrofit these facilities to get them up to this specification. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions, but let me conclude by saying that the Oregon Department of Agriculture clearly and strongly supports the expansion of beef processing facilities here in Oregon, and we support the Oregon cattle industry, and we hope to work very, very hard, as we have in the past, to make sure that proceeds apace.
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask,
sure.
Is there any reciprocity in any of our trade agreements that we have to abide with?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative Nelson, the United States is party to a number of trade agreements, notably NAFTA, WTO, et cetera. What is more important than these trade agreements actually are the market-driven specifications. And what we are finding is that governments' trade agreements set minimum levels. However, the marketplace is much more stringent in its requirements on product. And so it is indeed the marketplace that is the ultimate arbiter of quality and specifications as it relates to cuts and wholesomeness. And so these trade agreements, while setting a minimum, are not in any means complete in terms of explaining what is required by the marketplace, which is much more strict.
And just one thought. Would it be possible, Ms. Travis, if you could give us that information? For example, I'm curious, you know, if we were going to ship, a million head of Black Angus to Korea every year, do we have to accept so much of their product or Japan? I'm curious. And then I don't know what it is in the United States. I don't know. I mean, because if I were, you know, an Iowa beef processor, I'd be saying, hold it, Oregon beef just stops here, you know, ours goes further. I'm just curious if there are any of those restrictions, or is it just free market in the U.S.? I would just like to know that, you know, a little more about the market and also trade agreements and how they might restrict us. I think this is wonderful, and I'm so proud that we're doing this, and I hope we get to go over to Madras. Who owns this plant?
This facility, Mr. Chair, Madam Representative Nelson, this facility will be a partnership agreement that will be a combination of both equity and debt and with private investors, and does not at this time envision the need for public funds to construct it. And so it will be constructed using private sector funding.
And who owns it?
The facility is, the chief sponsor of that is a gentleman named R.L. Freeborn.
The Oregonian?
Yeah, he's an Oregonian. He lives in Terrebonne, Oregon.
Thank you.
He's a well-known entrepreneur in the cattle industry.
Great. Good for him.
Dalton, question for you. Over the last 10 years, how many loans have been made from the Oregon Business Development Fund and or from the Governor's Fund for the purposes of what this legislation addresses?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. I don't have the answer to that. Off the top of my head, I do not suspect much, given the fact that if you look at the state of our processing facilities and infrastructure right now, if there was money loaned to it, it didn't go to very good purpose. So I don't think, in terms of beef slaughterhouses in Oregon, I don't believe that there has been a whole lot that has been loaned there.
And probably not lamb either, I would assume.
Certainly not lamb.
Or pork.
Or pork.
Yeah.
Although there was, at the Masami Foods plant in Klamath Falls,
right,
I do believe that there was some significant participation on behalf of the Industrial Revenue Bonds and Oregon Business Development Fund and the Governor's Strategic Reserve on that facility, which processes beef as well as pork. I can certainly get from my colleagues at Economic Development a detail of that if you'd like.
And, I would, and have both of those funds, the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund and the Oregon Business Development Fund, they've both been in existence the last 10 years, haven't they? Or not?
I certainly within the last 5 years.
I
think probably in one form or another have been around for a number of years. You're correct.
So it would seem to me, and I want to make this point for the record, that even though there exists a current opportunity to access both of these funds, and I want to ask Ron later, and you also, to work with me to ascertain how many other funds might be available potentially, even though there exists the opportunity to access these funds, clearly we've not accessed them for the purposes of what this legislation is trying to address. And so it would seem to me that there is some validity to trying to move forward with a direction here that would clearly state we think this is a priority and we should have some at least short-term direction statutorily to try to dedicate some funds of economic development for this purpose, with the appropriate opportunities that if there isn't application made and there are, our projects are not approved, because there still has to be an approval process, that those dollars would be again made available for the current purposes of what they're being used for. So in that regard, it would seem to me that since we've not been successful, that we need to maybe try a different approach.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I might add, in terms of a little bit of background, one of the current phenomenon that you see with Mr. Bartel's operation, Walt's Meats up in Woodland, Washington, a lot of the reason for that is the fact that the marketplace has changed, and these niches have opened up, and there has been increased interest in the actual opportunity for slaughter plants to become profitable and to operate in a sustainable way. Up until a couple of years ago, there was a very good reason why slaughter capacity in Oregon was declining, and it wasn't because of inability to fund through loans or grants. It was simply that the marketplace could not support that. And I think that given our efforts at the Department of Agriculture to develop these leads, as we've developed for Mr. Bartels and others, we think that you will see increased interest in existing loan programs as they bring their program, bring their plants online. Certainly encouragement from the legislature in terms of giving policy guidance in that regard, I think would be very, very welcome. And trust me, we are working very hard in Korea and Japan to promote these products and have just begun in China now to take a look at that market. And I might add just one final thing, Representative Nelson, if you would like, we'll be more than happy to take you out this July, and you can watch 861 heifers, not heifers, excuse me, 861 live steers that will be loaded on board a special boat that will be bound for Korea. And we can give you all of the technical information related to the certification and documentation of these livestock to get them ready for export to Korea. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I think that's great. You know, I've been for the past, 30 years now, but we've been in the, we're bull shippers, horse shippers, chicken shippers, right. You know, aviation-wise, you know, moving them by DC-8s and, right. And 747s, and so this is an interesting venture. And I really want to just thank you for all y'all are doing. I appreciate this economic development because last year, last session, I really had the sense we weren't pulling together. There was only 3 economic development programs in the entire session last year. One was the elk ranching, one was the baseball stadium, and the other was burning straw for cogeneration of energy. And I just think we're so greatly remiss in supporting our people. And we talk about jobs, but it just seems like we don't dig in and move and, you know, make it happen. We have the same problem over at ODOT. And here, but we've got the resources. I mean, we really do, if we'll just, you know, get off a dime and make something happen. And so I want to thank y'all for caring enough to do it. I appreciate it.
Good point. Thank you, Representative. And Dalton, to your last point that there are new demands in the niche market that are opening up, and I think that only underscores my point that because there's new demands, we are going to need some participation. Because of these issues that you so articulately brought up and that I saw with my own eyes in Japan, of how they're looking for food security issues is their greatest issue, especially when it comes to beef, because of their mad cow problem,
right.
Not our mad cow problem, because we don't have one.
Right.
That just, again, I think points to why there needs to be some special attention, however we achieve that, from economic development in the coming few short years, so that we can take advantage of this emerging market now. And that's why I think it's important we move forward with something.
And with, Chair, can
yes.
I just say,
okay.
Let's don't forget China. I mean, let's get over there, because then we don't have to eat those dogs when we go.
And with that, thank you, Dalton. Thank you. I appreciate it. We're going to close the public hearing on these two bills, and we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Oh. Black ones taste best.
It's the whole quail, too, with their heads on. Oh, dear God.
Thank you.
Well, I think this is so good. Now, this is number... where's the other forest? You get the forest
thank
bill.
Thank you.